Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. We have a variety of topics.
Yeah, one of those more grab-baggy kind of episodes.
We're a couple days late. Two main topics, I would say, is, as you heard up top, that was the GameCube startup noise. Today, we are recording this on September 14th, 2016. This is the 15th anniversary of the day the GameCube, the Nintendo GameCube, launched in Japan. So the first day of the GameCube went on sale. It's been 15 years. That was a important console to my childhood.
It was the first console of that generation that I got. I got the GameCube, and then later, after I played Halo 1, I got the original Xbox.
So yeah. Same way for me, although I jumped straight to 360.
Right.
So yeah, it's an important console. There's a lot of cool stuff to talk about.
It had a handle.
Quirky machine.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that at the end of the show. That'll be just a nice, fun wrap up. Not going to do a huge retrospective, but, you know, we talked about the N64 earlier this year, and why not follow it up? And that was 20 years old, now this is 15 years old.
Have some of these more nostalgic topics where we can just wax about our childhoods and not have to get, like, angry about bad movies and stuff.
Exactly, and if at the end of the show we're going to be talking about gaming's past, before that we're going to be talking about gaming's future
as the
PS4 Pro. I thought of that on the ride over. The PS4 Pro was announced this week. This is the long anticipated PS4 Neo project we now know is called the PS4 Pro. They announced it at a rather strange event last week. On the same day that the iPhone 7 was announced, it was just a day of tech announcements.
Yeah, it was like right after that Apple conference too.
And it was kind of funny because I was trying to watch this stuff at work, but that was also a day at work where I was kind of driving around and having meetings. So I didn't catch like the entirety of either press conference, but I saw a lot of it, and some was like just listening to it in the car and things like that. So it was kind of funny. But yeah, we're going to talk all about that and those announcements, and then a little gaming present also, I suppose, as we're going to have some game reviews and things like that.
Yeah.
I've played some games, you've played some games, we've got some movies and news to talk about, but let's start with something that kind of bridges the gap between movies and games, and this is an interesting thing I did this week.
Okay.
I got to go see Kingsglaive, Final Fantasy XV. This is the animated Final Fantasy XV movie that is playing in certain theaters in different engagements right now. It has been since middle of August. It's on digital right now. You can get it on like iTunes or other digital stores for videos. And it will be out on Blu-ray and DVD in October, and it will be packaged in certain versions of the game when it comes out in November. So this movie is sort of... They clearly put a ton of fucking work into this movie. I'm going to talk about that. And while it's sort of ubiquitous, you can get it online, you can get it on DVD soon, I don't feel like they're giving it the push they probably should, given the amount of work that clearly went into this thing.
Right.
So I went to see this at the Draft House, the Alamo Draft House. They were hosting Colorado Anime Festival. And so this was part of the Colorado Anime Festival as they were showing this movie. So that was kind of cool. And actually, before I even talk about the content of the movie, I want to talk about two stories.
Okay.
Just from going to the Draft House while they were hosting this movie festival arm of the Colorado Anime Festival. The first is that a famous anime voice actor here in the United States was there at the screening and gave an introduction to the movie because he has some minor parts in it. And that's Kyle Hebert.
Okay.
He plays Gohan in Dragon Ball Z, most famously.
Yeah.
And also has been a narrator. That show has had many narrators. He was one of the narrators.
Right.
I'm not that familiar with the dub of Dragon Ball Z. He does not do the narration anymore, I don't think, like in Kai.
No.
But he still does Gohan.
Yeah.
Adult Gohan. He does not
Or like, it's always weird when they call him adult Gohan because it's, for the most part, it's like 16-year-old Gohan.
Yes.
But whatever. It's, it's Gohan all grown up.
Yes, so he plays Gohan, and he does tons of anime voice work. If you've ever listened to a dub in the United States, you've probably heard him. And he was a cool dude. He just like introduced the movie, and he said it was cool, and he talked a little bit about anime voice acting and the process of that and how weird it is to be in a booth and you hear the Japanese line, and then they give you like a 3-2-1 go, and then you have to just do a weird shout or something.
Yeah, like match it to the animation. Yeah.
And he talked about how most of his voice acting in Kingsglaive was background stuff where he has to go, "Ah! That kind of stuff, and he did some examples, and then he gave us a nice next time on Dragon Ball Z, and so that was fun.
Yeah,
and cool to see him there. And then this actually happened after the screening, but it was funny. After the screening, they had all these booths set up in the theater, not in the auditorium, but just in the lobby of little anime fest booths where they were selling different trinkets and art pieces and stuff. And one booth had some DVDs and Blu-rays out, and I wouldn't have given it a second look. You know, it had your normal stuff. It had your One Piece and
different. It had 900 volumes of One Piece.
I think it had the most, the latest one. It had Attack on Titan, things like that. Right. Popular anime releases at the moment. Like the latest Evangelion movie, things like that. But it also had a Persona item.
Okay.
But here's the thing. It wasn't Persona the video game. It was the Criterion Collection edition of Ingmar Bergman's Persona. And I saw it. And I asked the woman tending the desk, I said, did you guys, like, get the wrong version of Persona? And she said, yeah, they mixed up our order.
That's really good.
That's so fantastic.
Good movie, too.
I did. I said, that's a good... That's a, and she said, I've never seen it. I don't know what it's about. I'm like, it's good. Very different.
Yeah, it's, you know, you might like it, you might not. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like the artiest art house movie you've ever seen. So fairly different than Persona.
Yeah, that's like, I've had that where, like, it will be on, like, that movie will be on a streaming service or something, and I'll, like, see it out of the corner of my eye. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, oh, right, right, there are other things called Persona
right.
that are not the video game series Persona. Like, that term is way older than that video game series.
Obviously, so that was very funny, and it was just how, like, sheepish the woman was about it, too, of like, yeah, they sent us the wrong version.
My favorite part is that she still had it on display, yes, even though it was the wrong version.
She just put it out with the movies. I almost thought about buying it, because it would have been so funny to say, I got my copy of Persona.
You should have, like, got it, you should have bought it and then got it signed by the guy who voices Gohan.
Kyle Herbert, he was signing stuff. I totally should have done that.
That would be a really good story item.
It would. But good enough as it is. And the movie Kingsglaive, surprisingly good.
Oh, cool. I've heard some good stuff about it.
I only mostly have positive things to say about this. Like, I think if you look online and, like, for some reason you go look at the Rotten Tomatoes score, it's super low for this movie because that's professional critics and... I hate to play the card, this isn't a movie for critics, but this specifically is not a movie for critics who don't play video games, because it is, like, one, you already have to know some about Final Fantasy XV going into this movie. It does not just stand on its own.
Right.
And, you know, if you want to judge it on totally traditional terms, sure, that's a failing of it, but it's not what I was going to see it for.
Yeah, and it's like, it's a multimedia project. Like, it exists in relationship to the video game very specifically, so it at some point it feels sort of futile to try to criticize it without recognizing that connection to the game.
Yeah, and so, you know, like I said, a couple little things, like Noctis, who is the protagonist of Final Fantasy XV, does not really appear in the film, but he is a very important character around the fringes because things that happen in the movie affect him and he affects them. And they talk a lot about Noctis, and if you haven't followed Final Fantasy XV and know who Noctis is, that would confuse you.
Right.
Things like that. And then, of course, there's lots of lore and plot introduced in this movie that is set up for the game and does not get wrapped together. But with all of that in mind, and that's just stuff you should expect going in, I think, this movie holds together as a film much, much better than I thought it would. You know, it does have its own protagonist. His name is Nix. In the English version, he's voiced by Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad.
Because this has, like, a full, like, celebrity cast and stuff, right?
The top three. It's Aaron Paul and then two Game of Thrones people. It's Sean Bean and Lena Headey.
Right.
Sean Bean voices King Regis, who is Noctis' father. And Lena Headey voices Luna Freya, who is the woman who Noctis is going to marry in the video game. And the celebrity voices, those are really the main three. I don't think there are any other big celebrities. The rest of them are more anime people. All three of them are great. I mean, Aaron Paul, we know, can do voice acting from BoJack Horseman. He's on that show, and he's fantastic. He's very good here. Sean Bean, I thought he would just kind of phone this in, because he's Sean Bean, and he can, and no one would blame him. He's really good as King Regis, to the degree where I'm sure whoever voices him in the actual game will be good. But, like, I'm sad it can't be Sean Bean.
Yeah, it's like, you know, he did the voice for one of the main characters in Oblivion. I can't remember his character's name.
Right.
But yeah, he has some video game voice acting experience, but that was back in, like, 2006, I feel like.
Yeah.
Sean Bean's not going to show up for Final Fantasy XV for the whole game, unfortunately.
Yeah, so he's very good. Lena Headey is very good, except she's roughly twice the age of the character she's playing. And because I feel like I know her as an actress so well, that's just a little weird. Because Luna Freya is supposed to be around the same age as Noctis, so like 18, 19, 20. And Lena Headey is like 40.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I'm just saying it's a little weird because she also has like this... She has like a Cate Blanchett-style voice where when you hear her, she just sounds wise and kind of old in that way. Like, Cate Blanchett wasn't that old when she made Lord of the Rings, but she feels like eternal.
Yeah.
Lena Headey has that same kind of voice. And I thought that wasn't a great fit, but it's a good performance. So it doesn't matter in the end.
Cool.
But yeah, anyway, I was saying with Nyx, that main character, he's sort of a member of the Kingsglaive, which is the title of the movie, and that's the basically the small army of this kingdom that King Regis rules that kind of goes out and protects them from the oncoming invading army of Nilfheim and all that stuff, the basic lore of Final Fantasy XV. And basically, you know, Nyx is drawn into this conflict. The main arc of the movie is it's about what is the event that instigates the start of the game as well, which is the invasion of the main kingdom, which I'm forgetting what it's called now.
Yeah, I can't remember either. It's on my head.
Lucius. Yeah, Lucius, I think that's what it's called.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, by Nilfheim, the evil city, the evil country, I should say. And so it's about that invasion, and so it starts a little before that, and then most of it is about the invasion and the immediate aftermath and what happens in the city, with Nyx being our point-of-view character and protagonist, because in the game, you play as Noctis, who is outside of the city when that happens. So I think that's actually a pretty smart idea for a movie, and it automatically gives them room to tell a story that has a beginning, middle, and end that will help you understand the main video game, but can be its own satisfying story on its own.
Right.
And within that, you know, framework, they actually do a very, very good job, I think. It's a really, more than anything else, stunningly animated and produced movie. The animation in this is better than so many modern, like, big-budget CGI movies by Hollywood. It's stunning. Like, they do the photorealistic human thing better than I have ever seen it done in a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, because, like, Hollywood basically completely gave up on that.
Mostly.
Like, years and years and years ago.
Well, Robert Zemeckis was trying it with, like, Polar Express and Beowulf and stuff like that. But really, he was the last one doing it, and then once his company shut down, the photorealism doesn't really happen. But it's very well done here, and like, there are some moments where you can tell, that, okay, they needed more time to finish that shot, and that face in the background doesn't look perfect. But in terms of main close-ups and everything, it's very, very impressive and photorealistic on the humans and on a lot of the surroundings, while also being very stylized. And if nothing else, if you know you're waiting for your Final Fantasy XV fix because you think this game looks cool, this movie gives you just a nice two-hour pure injection of the lore of this world and the look of this world.
Which is awesome because that is the stuff that so far leading up to Final Fantasy XV is the stuff I'm most excited about. I think like their setting and what they're going for with that is so awesome, and it's why I've enjoyed like that Brotherhood prequel or like kind of like sister series or whatever in the anime, and that like and their trailers, like all that stuff seems so fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. So, and in this movie, you really get to have a nice deep dive into the visual design of this world, and it holds together very well. It's got cars and it's got modern aspects, but it's also got big summoned monsters and it's got wide open fields and things like this, and it's got crystals. The second word of this movie is crystal. I mean,
okay, that's the right way to go for a Final Fantasy thing.
Absolutely. It's about the power of the crystal. It's great.
You know, like the Final Fantasy VII Advent Children, they never say crystal in that fucking movie.
Yes, exactly. So all of that is really cool. There are some action sequences in this that just blew my fucking mind. Like, I can't name the last American animated movie that was sort of action-focused and had action just on this kind of scale and with this imagination and was just this well-executed. And often because, you know, animated movies do not exist in this kind of genre, but it kind of makes you sad that they don't, because the people who worked on this are so good at what they do, and the animation is so great. The music in the movie is phenomenal. The majority of the film score was not written by the woman who is scoring Final Fantasy XV, but she provided some of the main themes. And if this is what the music of this game is going to sound like, strap yourselves in. This is going to be an emotional ride.
Awesome.
I'll just say that. But no, the movie has a really, I think, clear and good story. There are some confusing things in terms of how much lore they're piling on at moments, but I think the overall like arc of the Nyx character, what happens to him, what he has to do, it's very good. And like I said, the acting and the characterization is mostly good. There's one character and one performance that fell very, very flat for me. And I think mostly it was just the English voice acting. I'd be very interested to hear in Japanese if that's maybe resolved a little bit. It just was an awkward dub voice,
right?
Which happens. Yeah. So other than that, though, very good. The last, like, 30 minutes of this movie, just everyone in the theater, too, because it was an almost full theater. You could just tell people had their jaws on the floor by what was going on. Like, I think most people are going to see this movie at home. But if you have a chance to go see it in a theater, absolutely do, because it is one of the most stunning big screen experiences I've seen this year. And that's not to say it's necessarily one of the best movies I've seen this year, but it's a good movie. And in terms of being a theatrical experience, it really is that. Like, it looks like they just poured fucking money into this thing. And they probably didn't, because I don't know how much money they have to spend on this ancillary thing. But it definitely looks awesome and expensive and cool. And yeah, like I said, good story, lots of good lore, some very surprisingly emotional moments. And by the end, you know, I felt like I'd gotten a complete experience, but I also felt more excited for Final Fantasy XV than I have at any other point in this game's development. And if that is not the goal of this movie, I don't know what is.
Yeah, that's awesome. Like, I really want to watch this thing, but I'm kind of waiting to get a bit closer to the release of the game so it's more fresh. But
That's I was pissed off walking out of the theater and being like...
Because you're like, fuck, it got delayed, so it's like at the end of November now, goddammit. Right.
So, I mean, like I said, the movie... And I should note this. The movie's coming out on Blu-ray and DVD October 4th. And if you are someone who had the collector's edition of the game pre-ordered, that's the $90 steelbook, and I had that pre-ordered because that comes with the movie.
Mm-hmm.
However, don't get that version if you want the movie, because the Blu-ray version, there's a special edition Blu-ray coming out on October 4th. It's only $5 more than the regular Blu-ray. And you not only get this movie with special features, you get the entire anime Brotherhood that is extended with a sixth episode.
Oh, that's cool.
So that does not come in the collector's edition of the game for whatever reason. So it is actually cheaper to just buy the standard version of the game and this $25 Blu-ray, and then you have all that stuff, and it's more than you would get in the collector's edition minus that nice steelbook. So that's what I've changed my pre-orders to.
Okay.
Because I kind of like the idea of owning this movie and the anime and everything and having it, like, on the shelf next to the game. So just wanted to fill readers in on that.
Cool, yeah.
But good movie, fun experience, really glad I saw it. What have you been up to, Sean?
Well, like, I just want to mention one thing just because of, like, that anime stuff. Reminded me that there was some news that hit a couple of days ago. This is not a big deal, but I feel like for our audience it might be of interest, is that Crunchyroll and Funimation have entered a partnership where that's really interesting to me, where Crunchyroll has always done really well by sort of like the streaming stuff and the studs like for subtitling Japanese anime and bringing that over here, and Funimation has always been a lot better for the distributing physical releases and doing their dub stuff. And so Funimation has had for a while now a streaming service that I've, like, subscribed to sort of on and off when there's something on there I want to watch, where that's sort of comparable to Crunchyroll's, only it's a bit shorter, or it has a bit smaller selection and it's focused way more on dub stuff. And so now Funimation and Crunchyroll have sort of entered this partnership where in the future Funimation is going to handle most of, like, the physical release stuff, and their streaming service is going to focus mostly on dub shows, and then they're allowing Crunchyroll's service to have a lot of access to Funimation shows like Cowboy Bebop that just got put up on their service.
So awesome.
Yeah, which is just like a cool, like, just like a cool surprise announcement that feels like it's really satisfying for someone like me that is so into modern anime, and it's such an amazing time to be into Japanese animation in the West, because you have all these opportunities and these venues to get access to it, and this, like, sort of partnership that Crunchyroll and Funimation are entering into, just, like, sort of, it's just the sort of sigh of relief of, like, this industry feels healthy over here again in a way it was not in, like, the mid-2000s, you know? It's, like, it's stable. Like, Crunchyroll and Funimation aren't, like, they're kind of competing, but they're also working together to like, benefit each other's strengths and stuff like that.
I forgot to put this on the outline, but it's such an awesome piece of news, especially because, you know, Crunchyroll, as much as it has, does have these holes in their catalog, particularly where some of this classic anime is concerned.
Yeah.
Funimation has one of the best catalogs of that stuff you can get in the West, so team up. Awesome.
Yeah.
And that also means some of those modern Crunchyroll anime will get to be dubbed and given physical releases by Funimation, where otherwise they would just stay streaming.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, no matter how, like, what side of anime you fall onto, whether you, like, prefer the Japanese language stuff or you want your dubs, like, you get, like, this benefits you both ways. Like, Crunchyroll comes out stronger and Funimation comes out stronger, and they both just sort of cement their identities, and I think, like, that's really cool.
Yeah. So, no, I'm going to have to just pony up for a Crunchyroll subscription. Really, it's not the money. I don't care about that. It's a cheap service. It's more the time to watch anime.
Yeah.
But I need to do it.
But anime, it's great because episodes are only 22 minutes long, and most seasons are like 12 or 13 episodes long. So, like, if you've got an afternoon free, you can watch an entire anime show's, like, a whole airing in, like, 4 or 5 hours.
Sean, I don't watch an anime unless it's got at least 200 episodes.
Yeah, no, I've Every once in a while, I look at, like, that One Piece episode count, and I'm like, never. I'm never doing it. You fucking people are crazy. I don't know how I don't know how you, like, after episode 200, I don't know how anyone new ever watches One Piece, right?
Right. I mean, and that's the thing. If you were there on the ground floor, it's great for you, because you have this awesome show you get to watch every week and go back to your you know, these characters you love and everything for years on end.
Yeah.
But you can't really enter it now.
Yeah, it's terrifying. Yeah,
it is.
And anime is in a good place.
It's in a great place, and it's really fun, and it's awesome because this is just something on an academic level that academics and scholars have written about forever, which is that anime is the number one thing Japan produces in terms of unique content, in not just in entertainment, but just kind of in a manufacturing sense.
Mm-hmm.
And yet for decades, they were very kind of gun-shy about exporting it.
Yeah.
And the exporting of it was very kind of slapdash. And it has been through our lifetimes as well. Even when anime was big in the United States in the early 2000s, it was still a limited sample of what Japan produced.
Yeah, it was like you had your handful of shows like Dragon Ball and like Gundam Wing and Yu Yu Hakusho that hit really big on Toonami. But other than that, like the more sort of like weird, diverse, smaller shows never really penetrated the market.
But now anime gets to places like the United States with these big audiences the next day, and that gives more money back to Japan to produce more anime. So it makes that part of the industry more healthy as well. So definitely a really cool time to be an anime fan.
Yeah. So that's been happening. And other than that, honestly, I don't have much to talk about for the podcast specifically, other than I've almost beaten Doom again. Like, I'm really close. I've played through... I guess I'm like 80% of the way through. And it's one day I was like, you know what, I'm going to put No Man's Sky to the side and, like, come back to that later, because, like, I'm not really in the mood for it right now, and there's, like, a lot of information on, like, patches they're going to do in the future that add more content. I want to play more No Man's Sky at some point, but leave that to the side. It's a game I can come back to whenever I want. And I was like, I'm not quite in the mood for Hitman. I was just sort of looking at a bunch of my games, and then I just saw Doom, and I was like, you know what? You know, like, that Destiny expansion comes out next week, and, like, after that, there's other games I'm going to be getting. If I want to play Doom again before the end of the year, this is kind of my opportunity to do it. I was like, well, I'll maybe play, like, one level, like, because I all wanted to play it through on the Nightmare difficulty, which is basically the hardest one that doesn't have the, like, permadeath penalty, which is Ultra Nightmare. It's like, well, I've always wanted to play it through again on that, even though I have the Platinum Trophy. Fuck it, I'll play a couple of levels and then probably stop. And then, like, I played the first level and got to the end of that first level on that difficulty, which is... That difficulty is fucking brutal, particularly before you get a lot of the weapons and stuff. And I was just immediately hooked again. And so then the next day, I played through basically half of that game almost in one sitting. Nice. Just, like, with... Like, kind of having, like, a heart attack by the end of it, just in how intense and fucking just stressful it is. Because on that mode, you take so much damage, you are always almost dead. You're, like, constantly on the brink of death and just needing to kill enemies constantly to get health, which is, like, that mechanic takes on a whole other life when you play it on that harder difficulty, because it's, like, that is... You are fucked if you are not killing things constantly and then refilling your health, because for the most part, like, you can avoid a lot of the damage, but on some of those battle arenas, like, you're not going to be able to dodge everything. Like, you're going to have to take some hits and sort of figure out where you want to go. So, yeah, I just have been having a blast playing through Doom. Although I have hit a part in the game, I am the level past where you get the BFG, so I have all the weapons in the game, I have most of the runes in the game. If you've played the game, you know there's a couple of levels, which I love, that there's a couple of levels in that game where you have all the stuff in the game, and they just give you more levels. This is way better than most games where it's like, oh, yay, I got, like, the Sword of Destiny that slays, like, it does 5 billion damage and all this stuff, and I only have the last boss as the only enemy left to fight. Well, fuck, there's nothing, like, you know, I finally, like, hit, like, the end of my skill tree, and now there's nothing left for me to do in the game. Doom does it the right way, where if you're getting all the secrets and stuff, you have every weapon, you have basically all, like, the weapon upgrades you want, like, all of your weapons, like, at least one weapon mod on all of your weapons is fully upgraded and everything like that, your runes are upgraded, and then you still have a bunch of levels, and then it gets super fucking hard because you've encountered every enemy type in the game, and that's where they start throwing in boss fights, which I haven't quite gotten to that boss fight yet. And then I've hit a wall where it is so hard, I'm at an encounter that is so difficult, I'm not sure if I can physically do it. So I'm going to probably like bang my head against it a little bit after we finish this podcast, and I might have to decide that that's as far as I'm able to go on Nightmare at Doom, at least at this point in my life. But
yeah.
But yeah, that game is so good. If you have not been paying attention to us on this podcast, seriously, like, I'm... one of the reasons why I wanted to play through it again, or play through most of it again before the end of the year, was to sort of, like, go back to it and be like, is that game really as good as I thought it was when I played it, or was
it...
Yes,
it is.
...partially, like, how much of a surprise it was? But no, yeah, it is as good as I thought it was. Like, it is... If something can knock it off of the Game of the Year list, like if or at the top of that list, it's like if Final Fantasy XV is that good, or if The Last Guardian is that good, like I will be amazed, because Doom is, other than like The Witcher 3, which has this like story stuff that sort of separates it, Doom is the best game of this generation so far. So,
interesting. So I like hearing you say that. It's funny. I wouldn't necessarily go that far because there's so many I love, but. Yeah. It's. I don't disagree with you on its quality. The thing is with Doom, I have already played it through all the way twice. Actually, right. When I was getting the Platinum, I had to play it two times through.
Yeah, I probably kind of played it twice through. Like, I played a lot of the levels twice to go back to get secrets that I missed, but yeah. I never, like, did it in sequence
and
twice.
And I did have to, because my first playthrough, I didn't quite do it right to get the trophies, so right. I went back, and I just loved it so much. So I spent a ton of time with that game, platinuming it, probably more time than you did. And I still kind of want to go back and play it again, just because it's so good. This has been a ridiculously good year for games. Doom is absolutely in that top tier. I am still shaking out my thoughts on what is like number one and two and three and stuff. But no doubt about it, it's a revolutionary first-person shooter.
Yeah, like I feel like if you take it on raw game design, Doom is the best game of this generation. When like you take story and stuff into account, like you know, then like maybe you could say Uncharted 4 edges it out. Like I would say that for me personally, Witcher 3 I like more, but like they're so completely different kinds of games that it's kind of stupid to try to compare them at some point.
No, I think in terms of like you know the AAA kinds of games you're talking about. Yeah, in terms of raw gameplay and game design, yeah, it's tough to argue against that.
It is a really, really fucking good game.
Yeah, but great year for game. I can't wait for our year-end retrospective, which is going to be 7 hours long.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to have to break games out separately. I just know that already.
Yeah, that's going to be its own podcast, yeah.
All right.
But I know you've been playing a lot more game stuff than I've managed to get in, so...
I have, and I've been playing what you've long been saying is one of the best games of the year.
Yes.
And that's Hitman.
Yes.
Literally, Sean, the last podcast we recorded, I think it was like a Sunday afternoon, and you told some more Hitman stories because you got to play.
I told my story of the Marrakesh map and poisoning the dude and one of my favorite things that's happened in that game.
Yes. So, was it Marrakesh or the...
It was that story happened on Marrakesh. It was in the consulate.
I see. Okay, because you were talking about the fourth episode, but then you went back to the third.
Yeah,
episode.
Yeah. Because I had gone back to get some of those challenges. Okay.
I see what you mean now. Okay, awesome. But you were talking about it, and I was like, okay, fuck it. And I literally, Sean, I drove home. I went to my PS4 and I bought the game.
Great.
Like,
yeah.
Gotta play it. I actually started with just the $15 starter pack.
Sure.
Because I was like, I didn't want to drop $60 right away. I had dropped $60 by the end of the week. But it was like,
you know,
because I didn't know how much I was going to love it, even though you talked so much about it. But I did that, and man, Hitman is really good.
It's a really fucking good game.
I don't know if I'm quite as in love with it as you are, but I really, really like it. And I think the episodic model is really cool because it's just each episode is so rich. And I honestly wish I had more time to just spend with each of those.
Yeah.
But every one of them has their own unique strengths, and they're also diverse and creative. I just love all of that stuff with it. I mean, I even love the prologue missions. Like, the first episode is Paris, but the prologue has two sort of smaller missions. And both of those, honestly, while they are smaller, I think they are every bit as good of examples as game design as the bigger episodes.
Yeah, and they're smart because they are like they are like miniature versions of what the full episodes are. So it's like you get the sense of like, okay, like especially the second one, it's like, okay, you have the opportunities and there's like a handful of them and you can see all the ways you can complete this one objective in this like smaller scale map. which allows you when you go into Paris, which is much bigger, to sort of grasp like the general flow of that game and how you are meant to sort of accomplish your objectives.
Absolutely, and in fact, if I have any complaint about the game, and this is kind of strange to call a complaint because it's not necessarily something I think the game does poorly, but I like those concentrated early maps so much, and I think sometimes I get a little overwhelmed by the sheer size of the bigger episodes and how much there is to do. Mm-hmm. I almost wish there were a few more small ones like that sprinkled through, because I like just the pure concentrated form of that, like the yacht at the beginning or the little military base. But I'm getting into the bigger ones. They just take a little adjustment.
Yeah, and I think it's something where it's like, because you, I don't think you probably haven't like spent enough time of like, because you just got it, of like going back through the maps multiple times a lot, where it's like, once you start doing that and, like, you do the elusive targets and stuff like that, which the next elusive target is coming up this week, like, then you start getting this feel for the map such that, like, for me, like, particularly that Paris one, because there have been a couple of elusive targets there that I've done since I got the game, like, I feel like I know that map, like, the back of my hand so much that's, like, and I have level 20 mastery, so I have, like, all the different places unlocked and stuff that I feel like, if I look at the picture, I'm like, I basically know that guy's on the third floor. I know like a dozen different ways I can get to that third floor within 5 seconds, even if I don't just spawn there.
And I am definitely familiar with Paris and Sapienza. I've played a ton of. I've gotten about half the challenges in both.
Right.
You know, I'm like level 10 to 15 mastery. So I like those. I've also done the alternate Sapienza version that they did for the summer stuff, where you kill the movie star.
Yeah, the movie star one, that's fun.
I actually, just as a mission design, I like that one better than the base Sapienza. And the base Sapienza is great. Like, as a map, it's bigger and better.
Yeah.
But just for the mission design of what you have to do, the movie version of Sapienza is fucking hilarious. And I love
the movie star guy has some really choice lines in that, because he's such a dick.
And there's just, like, one of the great... The game has all these great breakthrough moments. You and I were talking about this off the air a little bit, but the first time through any episode takes a very long time. It can take, you know, you can sit there and play a level for 2 hours if it's your first time through, and that's a mission. But then the more you do it, you get faster and faster until sometimes you realize, like, I can do this in like 2 minutes if I want to.
Yeah.
And one of my great moments of realization with that was I played that Sapienza movie one a lot. And at one point, I would do this thing where I would get in the movie star's trailer and kill him from there in a variety of methods. And I realized, oh, I can actually get to the trailer unseen, like just in my suit, very early in the map. I just have to run over here and like throw a coin to distract the guard, and then I jump in the roof of the thing. And it's like, that was just this great moment of realization where it's like, the first time I played this map, I probably spent an hour on this mission.
Yeah.
Now I can like just smoosh it all together, and I'm doing it in like 3 minutes, and then I'm just out. And
yeah, like
there's moments like that that are just kind of magical.
Yeah, like I had a very specific moment that was very specifically like that on the Bangkok map, which is the fourth one, where like it was this thing where I was trying to get one of the challenges, which is like one of your sniper challenges, which are pretty hard to find or like to execute on, because you have to sort of figure out the right spot in the map where you can snipe the targets and stuff without being seen by other people. And I just had this revelation where I was looking, exploring the map, and I was like, oh my god, there is a pipe that connects this room to this room. I've played this map literally like 7 times. I have spent hours in this map. I never noticed this. I'm going to back out, replan my mission, load in here. It's like, I could go, and I literally completed the mission in like 2 minutes and 45 seconds, because it's like the entire, like the way the you move around the entire map just completely changed for me as soon as I realized you could go from here to here without anyone seeing you at all. I was like, holy fucking shit. Like, if I had known that 5 hours ago, like, all these other challenges would have gone in a completely different way.
I've had some things like that, especially on the military map early on, the prologue one. You can jump over a fence, and I didn't know that, and so when I was starting it, I kept doing this thing where I had to throw a coin to distract one guard to take out another guard, and I was like, you're not supposed to do any of that.
But it's
fun. I mean, it does speak to the game's really incredible strength that these maps are meant to be played over and over and over, and they keep feeling fresh because you keep discovering things and playing them in different ways. And sometimes it can be a gritty shoot 'em up, and sometimes it can be a, you know, Metal Gear-esque stealth game with some goofy aspects. And sometimes it's just pure detective work and stuff. So it really does cross all these genres, and it is so unique to itself and so sure of what it wants to be. And actually, my favorite experience with the game so far was a few nights ago. I finally moved on to Episode 3 and played Marrakesh. And I have not gone back to Marrakesh and, like, gone deep into doing all the other challenges and stuff. But just on first blush, that's my favorite of the maps so far. Okay. Because there's just a scale to it that there was so much, like, chaos to the chemistry set that is the game.
Yeah.
And so many things I found I couldn't account for, and that almost, that level of unpredictability kind of made it more fun for me in some way. Like, the way I played the Marrakesh map, when I start one of these episodes, is I just explore for a little bit and see what I can find, and I don't look at any of the hints, I'm just going to see what I can do with it. And so for this one, I was just exploring. You know, the Marrakesh map, if you don't know, has this giant bazaar, which is a technical masterstroke on one level.
Yeah, it's like when you play Dead Rising on the Xbox 360, you're like, look at all these zombies, to like the nth degree, where it's like the crowds in Marrakesh are unbelievable.
They're unbelievable, and that's just the normal crowds. Once you get closer to the consulate, there's rioting crowds, and that's a whole different thing. But anyway, so I was exploring, and at one point I found myself in a building, and I'm going through the building, and I get to a stairwell, and a soldier is coming down. And I'm like, oh, this is great. I need a disguise. Because at this point, I recognize I need to get in that consulate.
Right.
I bet a soldier disguise will get me in there. So I'm in the stairwell, and I kind of look around, and I use my hitman vision, whatever you call that.
Right.
Instincts, is that their word
for it? Yeah, I think it's instinct vision or something.
Everyone has a different stupid word for that thing where you hold down the right bumper. And
yeah, for me, like, when I recognized that as a trend was in Arkham Asylum, and so for me it's just always called detective mode in my internal vocabulary.
Exactly. So I go into detective mode, and I was like, there's no one around, and this is an abandoned stairwell. This is a great place to do it. So I take the guy out, I, you know, choke him.
Yeah.
And as I'm doing that, someone walks in that I just missed. Mm-hmm. And so a girl, basically, who lives in the building, basically came out of her apartment and was coming up. And she's like, oh, my God. So I kill the guy. I drop. I just snap his neck. And then I pull out my silenced pistol and shoot her in the head. And I'm like, okay, hopefully I've contained this.
Yeah.
And then another soldier heard the gunshot.
Yeah.
And so I spin around, and he's at the top of the stairs. And I shoot him in the head. And that brings in, like, the girl's husband. And so I have to kill him. And so within 30 seconds, I've gone from being stealthy and, like, I'm doing this well. And there are four bodies dead in the stairs, and I have nowhere to hide them.
Yeah, there's, like, no boxes anywhere. And you're just like, I'm just going to pull these into this corner. And then, like, 30 minutes later, you just see, like, body found, body found, body found, body found. Oh, exactly. Fuck. I can't go back to that side of the map anymore.
Exactly. So I took a soldier disguise. I had my pick at this point because I killed two of them. And then I went into the consulate. And for a while, I was doing pretty well. But the way I decided to kill I think it was the general guy, is
right,
you can do this thing where you can hack into the radio and give him this signal that will make
him
go
meet in the underground tunnel. Yeah,
yes. And so then I found the underground tunnel. But when I was down there, I realized, oh, if I'm going to take this guy out, I need to take out some of the soldiers. Like, and I don't mean take out, like, kill, but just subdue and get them into a closet so I have some room to play with here. And so I start to take out the first guy, and I thought I had it lined up right, but I didn't. So I thought I was being stealthy, and instead, again, like, four bodies down.
Yeah.
And then the general dude comes in, and he's talking to me. And I'm standing, and I have a screwdriver at this point because I've run out of ammo in my guns, and so the last soldier I had killed with a screwdriver in the stomach.
Yeah, you just have this bloody screwdriver here, and it's like, oh, I cut myself, General, don't worry about it.
And I've killed, like, two people with this screwdriver. I'm still holding it, and I'm standing next to a gas barrel, so I'm like, fuck it, this has to be a challenge, right? So I stab the gas barrel, the gas comes pouring out, and he's like, what's going on? And then I think whatever happened, I basically had to ignite the gas, so I took out my gun, and, like, with my last shot, I just shot the ground, and he ignited in flames.
Yeah.
And, of course, that brought two more soldiers in, and I shot, and I basically had the biggest, like, firefight I've had in that game. But at this point, I also knew the map pretty well, so once I dealt with everyone, I was in the clear, because no one else was going to come down to this underground base, so it was littered with bodies, but I was okay.
That's one of my favorite parts about the game, is that I feel like it is strict and lenient in the perfect ways of, like, you want to get through everything perfect and be this ultimate, like, stealth assassin man who's, like, no one ever even notices that you were there. The reality of most of the times you play the game is like what you say, where, you know, you fucking, like, strangle a dude. You're like, okay, I'm just gonna grab this guy and put him in this box. And then a chef walks through a door. You're like, well, this is gonna be a thing. And you throw a screwdriver into his skull and, like, all this. And it's just this fucking ridiculous, like, comedy of errors. But what's the great part is that you can get away with that stuff once you're, like, discovered and there's an alert. There's a lot of ways that you can, like, get away, or you can kill the right people. And it's like, the way that information spreads throughout the map feels realistic enough that, like, you're not, like, sort of, like, feeling it's video gamey all the time, but at the same time, like, it gives you this room to play with it.
Yes.
That way, like, if you're not, once you're discovered, it's not like, well, now I can never wear the soldier uniform because I was saw in the soldier uniform. Like, if you kill the person who saw you in the soldier uniform before he tells anyone, and you just throw his body in, like, the river or something, you're fine. You're Scott. Like, who knows? Who cares? Like, yeah. You're scot-free.
So that was great. That was only one half of the Marrakesh mission. My favorite moment of it all was from that underground base, you can go back upstairs into the consulate.
Yeah.
And at the top of that stairs, there's a little room you can go in that has a place where you can kind of dump your weapons and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had a costume or a uniform already, like, saved there, and it was a security guard, so I could change and kind of be scot-free.
Yeah.
And so I went into this room, and it was just the funniest thing of, like, I took my bloody clothes off, and I changed. And then I just had dumped, like, because at this point, fighting the soldiers, I had picked up, like, six guns,
yeah.
And I dumped every gun because I was going to have to get frisked. And so I'm like, I dumped everything, and then I forget how I wound up killing the second guy, but it wasn't all that clean either. So yeah. When I got out of Marrakesh, I had just the highest fucking body count, and while I got actually a negative score, I right, hit yeah, zero, yeah. It was so much fun. And I look forward yeah. to playing that map through stealthily, but I love that just if you just tell yourself, I'm going to play this the way the chips fall, you can still have so much fun.
Yeah, and like it allows you to... It's one of those things where I love the modern stealth game genre so much because, like, 10 years ago or something when, like, you were, you know, it was like Splinter Cell Chaos Theory and the old Hitman games and that generation of stealth games and, like, Thief and stuff... It was once you were discovered, you were completely fucked, and there was yes. nothing you could do. And, like, either the game would literally be like, we need to pull you out, Sam, and you have to load your checkpoint because the fucking guard saw you. Or it was like the alert state was so severe that you might as well just reload your save because you're never surviving this. Like, modern stealth games, and Hitman is one of these, although Hitman's sort of different in terms of how it handles stealth, gives you that room to just be like... You know, it's the way that scene would play out in a movie or something, is that it's not just like, oh, he gets shot, it's done, and it's like, there's nothing you could do. It's like, now, like, things just get ratcheted up to 11, you're like, well, I need to, like, fucking shoot this dude, and shoot that, I'm like, I shoot this guy, and I don't have any ammo, but I picked up this coconut in the kitchen, so I'm just gonna throw a coconut in this dude's head and run away and hide in this fucking closet and hope no one sees me. Then I, like, leave and, like, fucking strangle a tour guide or something, put his hat on, and I walk away, and no one knows what happened, you know?
It's a real blast, and it's built in such a way that I think you can put the game away for a while, come back to it, and the controls and systems are simple enough that you're never... It's like riding a bike. You're never going to forget that, and you can get back into the groove pretty fast.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a ton of fun. I am putting it aside for a second because I'm playing some other games at the moment, but I can't wait to come back. I have to play that fourth episode so I can get ready. Episode 5 is coming out on September 27th.
Yep.
Which is like D-Day for video games. The Final Fantasy XV was going to be there. Thank God yeah. it isn't anymore. But there's already a ton coming out in these next 2 weeks. But anyway, excited. It's in Colorado.
Yes. So. There's going to be 4 targets, which is
crazy.
Insane. Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm really excited. It's just something. It's one of the great things about the way they're designing this game is that all the episodes feel very distinct while all operating under the same basic mechanics. They force you to play them in, like, really subtly different ways. And so I'm super excited to see what this next episode's going to be. I'm glad that you're playing it, so now we can talk about it on the podcast and we can feed off of each other instead of me just, like, ranting about this game like a madman.
Yes, absolutely. So we will probably talk about that episode when it comes out, but I know we're going to definitely save a lot of our Hitman discussion, and once episode 6 is out and the season is wrapped up, we'll do a dedicated episode to the game.
Yeah.
And I think it deserves that. It's worth talking about and just swapping fun stories and
stuff.
Yeah,
swapping fun stories and talking about, like, the way that this is... Like, I've been thinking about it so much since I played this game about how, like, this game has justified a business model that I thought was basically dead in video games for years now. And, yes. like, all of a sudden, this game comes out of nowhere. It's like, oh, okay, this is how you do episodic video games. This totally makes sense. I can't believe nobody ever did this before.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. So, cannot wait to talk about that more. Some other games to talk about briefly, though, and they're Xbox games. So, these next 2 months have a number of sort of either Xbox One exclusives or games I play on the Xbox One because I play them with my brother, and that's right. his console. So, I'm going to be playing back to my Xbox, which I actually had unplugged until this week. So, I had not had it plugged in for a couple months because it's a drain on power.
Right.
But I do like the Xbox One. I mean, I realized we will talk about this more when the PS4, when we talk about the PS4 Pro.
Right.
I have no need for a beefier PS4.
Right.
I really am excited for the Scorpio thing. Because the Xbox One has so much cool stuff about it. And God, is it a slow, hunky piece of shit.
That fucking UI is so terrible.
They've improved it so much, and there's so much that's nice about it, except I click on my games and apps, and it's like, okay, I'm gonna go get a Coke while it loads that.
Or it's like you press the B button at the main menu, and all of a sudden you're, like, looking at your network connection or something, because the last time someone used this Xbox, they were, like, changing their password or something. It's like, where the fuck, how did I get, where am I in this UI? Like, the way that I feel so uncomfortable in the Xbox One UI is, like, a weird, profound thing. I don't know if that's a personal thing. I don't know if that's, like, a human psychological thing. But the Xbox One UI sometimes just makes me feel like I'm unhinged. Like, you pull that the rug out from under me. I'm like, where am I in this UI? Like, where am I going? I don't know what to do. I've fucking spent more than enough time using this fucking machine. I should be fine.
No, it's... it's a problem. I think the UI has lots of strengths, but it also does have its weaknesses. And I think some of the weaknesses, honestly, at this point, is that every time they make an improvement, you can only replace a UI on a device so many times before that device gets slow.
Yeah.
We've all experienced this with our iPhones, for instance, where if you have an iPhone 4 and you're trying to put iOS 10 on it this week... well, I don't think you can, but even if you could, it would just brick your fucking iPhone.
Yeah, it's like, so you'd scroll to, like, your second page of apps, and it would take, like, 10 seconds.
And we're kind of at that point with the Xbox One already, which speaks to how poorly the Xbox One launched, and speaks to, I think, the admirable efforts of the team to try to improve it, and they have improved it dramatically. I don't want to downplay that. But it just, I noticed that, especially because one of the things I did this week, while I was kind of just booting my Xbox One back up and kind of getting back into it, because I had not even downloaded the new UI yet, so I got all that stuff up there, and I was playing some games with my brother on Xbox Live, and we wound up playing some 360 backwards compatible games.
Oh, cool.
So we were doing it all through the 360 interface, because that's just emulated through there,
yeah.
And I was like, I missed this so much.
Yeah, that
it was so simple.
The guide thing on the 360 was so good.
So good. It's you just pull up the guide and it's there. There's my friends list. There's my achievements. I don't have to fucking search. And again, they've made it better on the Xbox One, but it's like if they just stripped all of that out and just did a 360 style thing, I would love them so much.
Yeah.
The 360 had such a good... by the end of its life, it had a lot of clunkiness in its UI, but that fundamental thing of the jewel that you brought up that they introduced with the new Xbox experience back in the day was a masterstroke.
Yeah.
And still has not really been surpassed, so...
Have you used the PS4 firmware update that came out, like, yesterday or 2 days ago?
I have not gotten it yet.
Okay. It has a thing in it that basically is like that. It's really nice.
I'm so excited for that. Yeah.
Check it out.
Because I've only been playing Xbox the last few days, so I have not used my PS4 and I haven't gotten the update, but I should.
Yeah, like it was the... because it kind of... It's really fast, but it basically works like how the original Blade thing worked on the original 360, where it just like pops out the side of the screen, and you have like your trophies and like a friends list and like your power options and everything right there.
Yeah.
You can customize how it's sorted like that. It's really well done.
No, and I'm glad they're doing that, because if there's one weakness I would point to with the PS4 UI, which I mostly adore, I don't love that when you go back out, you don't see the game anymore.
Yeah, so you have to back all the way out to the front thing. Although, like, I feel like the way that the PS4 handled it and the Xbox One handled it, like, both had their advantages and their disadvantages.
Yes,
where the thing the Xbox One does, on the other hand, that drove me fucking crazy, it was when you would back out, like, the music and everything would still be playing from the game, and I would be like, no, I'm trying to, like, listen to this YouTube video, or, like, I don't want this music to always be playing when I'm, like, you know, there's no way to get it stop playing if there's, like, music playing over the pause menu in the game. And that, like was kind of driving me crazy. But,
no.
Yeah.
Yeah, overall, I prefer the way the PS4 does it, but this seems like a really nice compromise middle ground, so we'll talk about that more next week, I'm sure. But anyway, so testing out that, I actually also got a new Xbox One controller, because I wanted to try one of these new Xbox One S controllers, so I bought one of those, not the Xbox Design Lab, just the default white one, and one, I love having a white Xbox controller again. I know the Xbox started its life as a black console, but it will always be white to me because of the 360. And then
you're racist, but...
That's not what I meant. I didn't say it was a Caucasian console.
You just like white consoles. That's fine. You just don't like black consoles. It's your preference. It's just your preference.
Anyway, so that's kind of nice to have a sort of classic-looking controller that way. But they've made some really nice improvements to that controller. The biggest thing that I know you would like, because of the way you hold controllers,
right,
is they fixed the bumpers.
Thank God, because so yeah, those bumpers are driving me crazy.
If you've never used an Xbox One controller before, the way you had to use the bumpers is you had to press in from the end of the bumper, and if you tried from the middle or the inner edge, it just wouldn't press.
Yeah.
So if you hold it like Sean does, where he has his fingers over the triggers and the bumpers
at the same time,
the bumper you would have to like press with your knuckle down here, and it wouldn't work very well. You can press it from anywhere, so it's fine. So that's nice. They've added this sort of coating to the bottom of the controller that feels a little bit like the PS4, where it's got kind of a grip plastic to it. That's a nice improvement. It's a little lighter. It's got the headphone jack integrated, which I know they'd added to some kind of in-between models, but I did not own any of those.
That's ironic, given some of like the other things that have happened with headphone jacks this week.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
We're putting headphone jacks into things and taking them out of other things.
Well, the headphone jack is and should be ubiquitous.
Yes.
But anyway, so all of that is nice. Better controller. You can decide for yourself if it's worth the $60. I just kind of wanted it.
Yeah, but if you're going to, like, you know, if you only have, like, one or two Xbox controllers, you might as well get another this one. And then, like, when friends come over, they can use the crappy old controllers.
That's exactly it, because I only have one.
Yeah.
So this was good, too. I needed a second one. I have two PS4 controllers. I needed a second one here. So this was good. And then I've played two new games, one of which is ReCore, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute and give my first impressions on ReCore, which has gotten some rough reviews, and I like it. So we'll get into
that. Well, the reviews are very specifically, this game's great for like 6 to 8 hours, and then it falls off a cliff, has been like every review I've read for that game.
Some of the reviews, yeah. I will talk about that. But the other game I've played is they released a demo of Forza Horizon 3.
Right, yeah.
And you'll know, I liked the E3 demo of that game so much.
It was a great demo.
So that I was excited to kind of try this game out. I'm really glad they put a demo out, because demos are always good.
Yes.
And I'm definitely going to buy this game now.
Awesome.
It is an awesome game. Like, if you have access to an Xbox One, you owe it to yourself to just try the Forza Horizon 3 demo, because it's free. And even if you don't like racing games, even if you don't want to buy the full game, that's fine. But if you just spend an hour looking at this game, your life will be better. It is one of the most absurdly beautiful games I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like, definitely the most impressive graphics I've seen come out of the Xbox One. And I don't play these kinds of games, racing and sports, all that much, so I know those tend to look very nice.
Yeah, because they have, like, very specific things that they need to focus on, and they don't have, like, huge crowd scenes and stuff like that.
Exactly, but this still just, it blew me away, because it's set in Australia, and just in the first hour, like, because I think it's just the first hour of the game itself, and it does a nice job of directing you to, you're going to go through some trees, and you're going to go through a desert, and you're going to be on the beach, and so it just gives you a nice kind of taste of the different environments, although I've only seen a fraction of the map. It's a very big open-world racing game. But just being in Australia is exactly as cool as we thought it would be at E3. That's such a unique environment to do a racing game, and they really clearly did their homework, did their research, put in the work to make this look right. But beyond that, like, the colors in this game of, like, the dirt and the trees and the sun and the clouds and the sky, like, the range of colors exhibited by this game just made, like, my mouth water. I loved it so much. And then being someone who is really interested in photography, both as a film critic, and, you know, I watch movies, and I also do some photography myself, one of my favorite things is the unique way, like, light from the sun moves through trees and things like that, and off of water and stuff. And it's not something that gets a ton of attention in video games, because it's a tough thing to replicate.
Right, yeah.
It's a tough thing to do in photography. Like, it's very rare that you'll actually have a cinematographer of a movie, for instance, point a camera near the sun. They're just not
good. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Natural light is something a lot of cinematographers, unfortunately, it's difficult, but I wish more did it, kind of shy away from. But I love natural light when you get it. And this game, like, clearly they did so much research into how natural light plays with things like trees. And I just spent so much of this game looking at the top half of the screen, looking at the trees and the skies and things like that, because I've never seen that done this well in a video game. And that alone, like, if the racing controls were shit, I would have enjoyed my time just driving around and just looking at things. But luckily, the racing controls are really good and a big improvement, which I know because they put Forza Horizon 1 out on games with gold.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
In as backwards compatibility. And so I got to play a little of that. Thomas and I were playing that online. That's one of the games we were playing. And so I have something to compare it to, and they've come a long way, which is nice. So, but it plays really well. The driving is really good. If you don't know what Forza Horizon is, Forza Motorsport is the main series, and that's like
It's a lot more like car simulation right. kind of stuff.
It's a racing game for people who are like super into cars and like, as you say, car
simulation. Yeah, they have like the Top Gear guys like yes. do voices for Forza. And for Forza Motorsport 6 was when they like lowered a fucking like the new Ford like car from the ceiling at E3 like 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. That was Forza Motorsport.
Yes. Forza Horizon is like the fun one for the rest yeah. of us, which is just sort of a little more goofy. It's got a rewind feature where you can bring yourself back and then redo what you did, stuff like that. And I really like that. It's the kind of racing game I would play. Yeah. And I tend to play a racing game like every 3 or 4 years. The last one I would have played actually would be Need for Speed Rivals at the launch of the PS4. Right.
That's what a tragic game that was. It had so much potential.
Yes.
It's just sub-design decisions. Fuck.
But Forza Horizon 3, from what I've played, gives me what I tend to want out of a racing game without some of the fluff, plus the Australian Outback. I will definitely play this game. I just had such a blast with... Like, I had to turn off the demo at one point because I'm like, I don't want to spoil myself on it.
Right.
I want to play the full thing. So I am very excited for that game.
Awesome. Maybe this will be the game... This will be the racing game post-Burnout Paradise that makes me feel like I can play a racing game that isn't just Burnout Paradise. Because Burnout Paradise was so fucking good that all other racing games have paled in comparison since.
Luckily, I never played Burnout Paradise, yeah. so I can go into other racing
Maybe
games.
Maybe one day they'll put that on games with gold, because it was... I think it is actually backwards compatible on the 360.
So oh, cool. Yeah, I should get that.
Man, Burnout Paradise is a really good game.
Yeah, it might be up there. I mean... They're doing a really good job with that backwards compatibility stuff. It's yeah. a really cool part of the Xbox One. But anyway, so that was that. And then ReCore. I was so on the fence about getting this.
Right.
But I was reading the reviews, and the reviews were pretty rough. Some people had the charitable view you were describing of, like, this game's got some really good stuff until this one point, and then they say it falls off a cliff. And some reviewers kind of hated the whole thing I saw. So, but overall, pretty rough for a video game these days to get right. reviews like that. But it was the kind of scenario, and I actually saw Ben Cachero over at Polygon wrote about this phenomenon. When you hear something negative about something, but it makes you want to play it, because it's like,
yeah.
but I want that.
Yeah, yeah.
And ReCore is so much a game I wanted to play, not just because it's by the guys who made Metroid Prime, but because it's in the style of a Metroid Prime or an adventure game from that PS2 GameCube era.
Yeah, it very much looks like a PlayStation 2 game that like got its like secret remaster or something and you never heard about it.
Absolutely. And those kinds of games just don't get made anymore. And I really wanted to play it, and I thought, you know what, it's only $40. If I get 6 hours of enjoyment and then it kind of falls off a cliff, whatever. Maybe those first 6 hours I'll really like, and sure. that's fine with me. And I'm about 4 hours in, so, you know, I am not by any means making a final judgment, but I really love this game so far. And I don't just like it. I got to a point last night where I was realizing, I think this is a really good game. And even if it falls off a cliff, because I kind of know what the complaint is, which it gets kind of grindy at the end.
Yeah.
And even if that's the case, and that happens later, I'll see what my reaction is to it and how it works, and I want to kind of form my own opinions. Even then, I do think the general press reaction is a little too harsh, because I think this game is doing some really creative and interesting things. It definitely has things like Metroid Prime in its DNA.
Right.
Like, to a big degree, to a point where I saw some reactions from like fans online saying, the bosses in this game are so hard, and I was thinking, they're really easy, and I thought, oh, it's because I've played Metroid Prime extensively, and I know how to fight these kinds of bosses, which right. is that this is a very similar move to what Samus has, where you can lock on, strafe, and kind of move around the damage. And if you kind of know how to do that, like, I just automatically had that in my mind to how to play this, and things like that. And I think if you were coming to it fresh, I can understand certain parts being more difficult. But anyway, it has that kind of stuff in its DNA, but it is its own thing. It's not quite a complete throwback game like that. It also has some open-world environment kind of stuff. Although I think that's deceptive, I actually think some people are sort of judging this as an open world thing, and I would much more compare it to like Super Mario 64 and its setup.
Yeah, I've heard it described as an overworld.
It's an overworld.
Which makes more sense.
Yeah, I think there's sort of, if you look back at the lineage of Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time,
yeah.
Mario 64 established the overworld thing, and Ocarina of Time established the open world thing,
sure,
you could say. Like in terms of modern, how we talk about these things. And this is much more an overworld where you kind of get places on the overworld, but that's not where you do the majority of collecting and stuff. There are dungeons with different challenges, and those dungeons are just so far, masterstrokes of platforming and exploration. Not just decent throwbacks, but very good in their own right in what they give you to do. I've played probably four or five so far, and I really like those dungeons. They're the best part of the game. But like the basic controls, you play this character, Jewel, and she, so
spelled like the energy measurement unit.
Yes, Jewel. Like, yes, it's fun. A lot of the spellings are fun. Like her dog is named Mac, but she calls it that because its serial number is like MA3K.
Okay.
And so she says Mac.
Right.
So just things like that that are just kind of creative. And I do like the story in this game. It is not a narrative-focused game, and I've seen some reviews that seem to think, like, they're judging this the same way you would judge Uncharted or something. And I'm like, no, that's it's lightly narrative, and I don't think it's asking you to heavily invest emotionally in the characters.
Right.
Because that's, to me, that is such a relatively recent thing in video games, where the narrative is king and is everything.
Right.
That, to me, that's still like the exception, even though I know that's not the case anymore. But just in my own history with video games, that's never been the dominant way I look at games, outside of like RPGs, I guess.
Right.
But anyway, so it's like lightly narrative. But the general story is you are on this planet named Far Eden. Earth is sort of dead, and you are going here to help terraform it, and some things have gone wrong. So that's the basic setup. So you play as Jewel. She has sort of this exoskeleton thing she's got on, so she can do this double jump and this dash. And just the basic movement controls are so fucking satisfying, of moving Jewel around, jumping up on things, the way they mix in, just genuine straight-up platforming. I have not seen just straight-up platforming done this well in a game not published by Nintendo, I don't even know in how long.
Because I mean, because everyone else has given up on it, basically.
Or platforming has become something else.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What you see in the Uncharted games definitely has platforming in its DNA, but I wouldn't call it platforming in the way I would ReCore or Mario or
right.
Kirby or something like that. But this just has straight-up platforming elements, and it's very, very well done. Because the controls are just really fun to use, and they find the right line between being forgiving, so like, you know, you're not just always going to be falling off stuff, but also being challenging. So I really like that about it. The combat system is third person, and you have this rifle that has basically, as you go through the game, you get these different color attachments for it. So it's sort of like there's a little puzzle aspect to the fighting where the monsters have or the robots and stuff you fight on this planet have different colors associated with them, and you will get a damage bonus based on which color you are using. And then you also have, in addition to that, your robot buddies.
Yeah.
And that's the best part of the game. The robot buddies are awesome. I've got three of them so far. Her dog, Mac, one of the best dogs in a video game ever. Already, I can just say, Mac is fucking cool. I like Mac. It's a robot dog.
Have you played Fable 2?
Not played Fable 2.
Fable 2 has the best video game dog.
I didn't say best. I said one of the best.
Yeah. Well, you know. Okay. Play Fable 2.
Oh, okay.
Then talk to me about
okay.
dogs and video games. God damn it.
But I love this dog.
I love that goddamn dog.
I love this dog. It's useful in combat and things like that. You get this little, like, spider robot named Seth. And Seth can climb. And the Seth parts of the game, like in terms of the platforming, are mind-blowing. Like, basically, Seth attaches to these rails that look just like the Morph Ball tracks from Metroid Prime and act somewhat similar. But they've basically taken that mechanic and turned it into a platforming roller coaster where the first time you use Seth, they kind of throw you into the deep end and you have to get way high up. And the way that works where he'll, like, you climb up the track and you go super fast up it like it's a roller coaster. And then he flings you and you have to, like, dash to the other side and get to this next rail. Like, I actively, like, I am not someone who's afraid of heights.
Right.
But I got a feeling of, like, anxiety in my chest of how high up I was and how the stakes were. If I actually fell here, I'm going to have to start this over again. And it felt like I feel like when I'm on a roller coaster or something. So that was really cool. And then I got the latest robot, who is this big brawler dude, and he can break rocks, and he's cool too. And his attacks in battle are awesome because he just sets everyone on fire. So the combat is really good. I think it strikes the right line for this kind of game between being intricate enough that the encounters are interesting, but not so intricate that it overwhelms what the focus of the game is, which is exploration and puzzle solving and platforming. It is not a shooter at heart, you know?
Right.
So I like all of that about it. I like the story progression so far. I have not really had a dull moment with it yet. I think the overworld is a little dull, but I also view it as an overworld, and that's not kind of the focus for me. And, you know, while going to some places, I feel like they could compact it a little bit because it's mostly just a big desert, and it can be a little dull traversing it. They also have a pretty intricate fast travel system, and once you've been a place, you don't have to walk there again.
Right.
So things like that. The game is technically janky.
Yeah, that's one of the major complaints I've seen.
Yeah, I have not... Well, maybe I have. I have not necessarily had the load time issues people are saying. Like, I don't think I've ever had a load that reached 2 minutes. They are long, But I don't think excessively. Like, load times are just kind of an issue these days. I feel like there's a lot of games with long load times. We've got these consoles with, you know, 5,000 RPM hard drives in them.
Right.
There's a lot of slow loading, and this does not feel excessive to me in comparison to games like Witcher 3 or something that also, when you die...
I mean, The Witcher 3 is, like, a big, massive open-world RPG that, like, it makes sense why, like, The Witcher 3 would have really long load times.
No,
whereas, I think, with, like, ReCore... I think, like, where, like, because one of the main complaints I've seen about it reading the reviews is that, like, the technical jankiness of it makes it feel like it is unfinished, as opposed to, like The Witcher 3 has technical jankiness, like Grand Theft Auto has technical jankiness, like the Bethesda games do, because they are these huge, massive worlds, and you can forgive it because at some point there's nothing the developer could do.
No, and I understand that, and I'm not saying it shouldn't and couldn't be better. It should be. The load times are too long for what the game is. But it just, I'm kind of used to sitting and, like, it does not detract actively from my enjoyment of the game. That's all I'm trying to say. What does detract is there are some frame rate dips here and there that are really excessive. Like, you're going sub 30 and it can get pretty rough. And it's only, it's not like it happens in places where it shouldn't happen. It does happen in places where there's a lot going on.
Sure.
So I understand it. But it does feel like, yeah, you could polish this more. And my understanding is that the PC version, which came out simultaneously, and I should be able to talk about more next week because my brother Thomas is going to download that because he has a Windows 10 PC, and this is the Xbox Play Anywhere thing. So he'll get it for free because I have it on my account, and I can kind of report back. But it lets you change the resolution and the frame rate, and apparently it runs really well on the PC with all of those. But on the Xbox One, it is fairly poorly optimized for a... you know, AAA first party release, and that is disappointing. It doesn't feel unfinished in the sense of like it's just broken, but there are places where it's like, yes, it needed some polish and optimization here and there.
Right.
Not enough so far to like make me mad at the game or give up on it or anything like that. It's just some parts where I'm like, oh man, I wish the frame rate were smoother here.
Right.
But I really do enjoy the game.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are going to be as you, like, when you finish the game and stuff. Because it is, the majority of the criticism I have seen has been very focused on, like, you, like, get to this one point in the game and past this, like, a lot of bad, like, there are a lot of bad decisions that were made.
No, and I'm totally cognizant of that. You know, I would be cautious so far in recommending it because I haven't beaten the game yet. But I'm also aware that, to me, this is not a game that if I get 10 hours in and then it gets annoying... that will not negate that I had fun with the first 10 hours to me. So we'll see. I don't know. It's, you know, it's not like if Uncharted 4 became super janky in the last half, because that's a narrative game where I really care about everything that happens at the end there.
Right.
But we'll see. I am enjoying it so far. I like that someone is trying to make this kind of game. And I'll say this also. The critical reaction has been bad. When I look at fan reactions, they're a lot more positive. And maybe that's because they too, have not finished it.
To the end of the game yet.
But, you know, keep everything in perspective is all I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, keep an open mind, obviously. But it's like just one of those interesting things where, like, I feel like we don't get... I feel like we used to get this kind of game and a lot of, like this a lot more back in the old day. Not just in terms of, like, the PS2 design-y kind of stuff, but also that sense of, like... oh, fuck, you hit, like, it's like 80% of the game is awesome, and then you hit this point where it's like, what the fuck happened to this game? I feel like that is very much a thing that is also symptomatic of that era of games that, like, you just, like, some games just, like, get terrible at the end and, like, fall apart, and they're, like, completely unfinished and stuff like that. Like, Knights of the Old Republic 2 very famously came out with, like, basically the ending completely fucked, and it's just, like, it's been a long time since I've seen those kinds of complaints that are, like, this game is really awesome, and then you hit this part, and then all of a sudden it's not, and we don't understand. Like it feels like everyone has, like, really sort of complicated feelings about the game.
Yeah, so I'm very glad I'm playing it, though. I'll just say that. I'm excited to talk more about it. Definitely going to try to finish it up this weekend, because fucking Destiny has its expansion next week, and then the floodgates just keep opening from there. So, lots of games. ReCore is fun. Forza Horizon 3 had a good demo.
Hitman Doom is awesome. A really good game.
Doom is a really good game if you haven't somehow played that yet.
Yeah, you should play Doom.
Lots of good games this year. Let's move on to some news.
Okay.
A couple pieces of news to hit.
All right.
Let's start with a gaming piece. The Last Guardian got what will hopefully be its last delay, but it was scheduled to come out October 25th. It is now scheduled for December 6th. So just a small delay, very similar to the Final Fantasy one of like... shit, more optimization.
Yeah, yeah.
We're about to go gold. Fuck it. Let's delay this sucker. And, you know, it is very nice that we are finally at a point where it seems like AAA developers are comfortable delaying their games.
Yeah.
and comfortable moving outside of that hallowed Thanksgiving window, because a lot of bad games have come out around that window because they're rushed.
Yeah, I mean, that was like 2 or 3 years ago where we had like...
The Master Chief Collection.
Yeah, Master Chief Collection, Assassin's Creed Unity, like back-to-back, where it was like, these games released utterly broken on a technical way on these consoles. How did this happen? And then, yeah, it feels like you say, developers are way, or the publishers are way more comfortable allowing these games to be delayed and putting them out, because I think people have seen that games do not have to release like pre-Thanksgiving for them to be able to sell. Like, I think the worldwide market is a little bit more important now than it was years ago. Like, America does not have like the entire like market like dominated the way it did back in the day. And so, you know, other places of the world don't give a shit about Thanksgiving and like fucking like Black Friday and all that stuff. It doesn't matter. Like, release the game when it's done. And if, you know, like, Last Guardian was situated right next to, like, Titanfall 2 and Battlefield 1 and Call of Duty Infinite Warfare. It, like, just, like, jumbled in with, like, the biggest releases of the year. Like, December is a little bit more occupied than it usually is this year, but, like, it still has a lot more space of its own, I feel, in December.
It does, and the kind of audience that was going to play The Last Guardian would play it whenever it releases.
Yeah.
Just like Final Fantasy XV has an orbit, and wherever you put it out, that orbit will draw people in.
Exactly.
You know, the gravity of that game is such that the release date doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and if you put it out, like, with not, like, right next to the biggest game of the year, like, maybe other people will see it behind the haze of Call of Duty.
Right.
It's just like that protracts so much dominance over the market, like those kinds of games, that like allowing a game to occupy a space in December or February or March, where like games usually don't come out, or like June and July, the way we saw with like Doom this year and Uncharted 4 this year, like some of the, or like The Witcher 3 last year. That's when some of the best games can now come out and just be the game you play for like that month and just get all that time, and it gets all the cultural attention around it. I feel like we are finally past this era where everything has to come and fall, and then there's no game that comes out for like the entire rest of the year.
Yeah. That being said,
yeah.
So in a 1 week period, Sean, starting yes. November 29th, we have Final Fantasy 15.
Yes.
3 days later, we have Gravity Rush 2.
Yeah.
3 days after that, we have The Last Guardian.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck are you and I going to do?
I don't know. Yeah, like somehow they put like all the games that like we specifically wanted to play those right are, next to each other.
Those are the exactly yeah. the three I am most excited for yeah. the rest of the year.
Yeah.
Like those are the three that I have, you know, pre-ordered on Amazon uh-huh. specifically.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it hit us pretty hard, very specifically.
Like, I'm probably going to have to, it's stupid, but I'm going to have to take time off of fucking work probably to finish these games.
Yeah.
Especially like, okay, Gravity Rush 2 can probably play pretty fast. Last Guardian probably isn't like a 60-hour game.
Yeah.
But Final Fantasy 15 is.
Yeah. Like, so, we might have to, like, delay our end of the year podcast or something a couple of yes. weeks to, like, give us time to finish Final Fantasy 15 in particular.
Yeah. I will probably just try to power through Final Fantasy 15 and then move on to the other two. But I don't know, man. It's tough going.
Yeah.
These games, man. It's crazy.
Yeah. They really packed it in for, like, our specific interests.
Yes. Thank God Persona 5 isn't coming out this year.
What would we have done? Like,
I don't know.
Yeah, like, just thank God, you know, that like stuff like Doom and Uncharted 4 didn't come out this fall. Like, thank yeah. God, yeah, that we got all that shit out of the way.
Yeah, and, you know, the stuff coming out up until the end of November is stuff I feel like I can move around and play in shorter bursts.
Yeah.
But then the big games are all in a week. It's crazy. But, you know, ultimately it's a good thing. Good yeah. games coming out, always nice.
Yes.
Talk about a good movie.
Okay.
You remember Mad Max Fury Road?
Yes, that is one of the best movies I've seen in a long time.
The absolute best movie of 2015?
Oh, fucking yeah.
Easily. Best action movie probably of this millennium so far?
Yes, I yes, would say so.
Maybe ever?
Yeah.
Great movie. George Miller, the director of that film, since the release of that film, has been talking about that he also made a black and white version of it.
Okay.
And he actually thought about shooting the movie in black and white up front, but no one would fund that because, sadly, no one makes black and white movies anymore, even though black and white is fucking awesome.
Yes.
So what he did, though, was he made the movie in color and stunning color, but he did prepare a special black and white version of it. And it's not just like he turned the contrast off.
Right.
He made it black and white. He did high contrast. He talked about it in an interview, what he wanted, and that it would come out on the DVD. Well, last year, the DVD and Blu-ray for Mad Max came out. No black and white version. So we were all kind of like, well, when's that going to come out? That sounds cool. And earlier this year, a Mad Max box set with all four films plus the black and white version of Fury Road was announced, but only for Germany.
Okay.
And so everyone was like, well, this has to come out in the U.S.,
you know,
right?
Like that famous German film series, Mad Max. I mean, everyone knows that George Miller is a German. The Mad Max movies were all shot in Germany. You can so tell.
So it's been coming closer and closer to the release of that German box set. I believe that comes out in October.
Why is it fucking German of all the countries?
I don't know. But it's coming out in Germany first, so... And we were pretty sure this would have to come out in the U.S. by the end of the year, but there's just wasn't an announcement. The other day, I just want my fix on this so bad, I looked up online, someone had made a fan-made trailer of Fury Road in black and white, kind of using the settings that George Miller talked about, and it looks so cool. Like, color is very important to that movie, but it translates to black and white exceptionally well, and I want to see, like, a polished, high-definition, finished version of it.
Yeah, me too.
And so finally today... I was walking out the door of my office and I got this alert on Twitter and I had to stop and like read the news report because I was so excited. This was announced through the Digital Bits website. They are putting out on December 6th in the U.S. that same Mad Max box set Germany is getting with the black and white version.
Hopefully with like an English language track.
Yes.
Hopefully it's not just in German, which is, as we all know, the original language in which all the Mad Max movies have been filmed.
Yes. You know? Mel Gibson, a famous German actor.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's where he came from. It's like he did some small indie films in Germany like the original Mad Max, and then he broke big.
It's why he has the values he has.
Okay, yeah, I wasn't going to go there with that joke. You could go there with that joke.
Anyway, Germany's a lovely country.
Yes.
It hasn't been anti-Semitic in a long time.
Yeah.
Anyway, but Mad Max, so it's got the four movies, including Fury Road, the black and white version, and it even has, in the Blu-ray set, the 4K Blu-ray of Mad Max Fury Road. So if you ever get a 4K Blu-ray player, it's just in there for free. So that's pretty nice. They're also going to release on that same day a set that is just Fury Road with the black and white version.
Okay.
So you can get it either way, December 6th.
Do you remember how much the full one costs?
The full one was, its MSRP was about $80, which means it'll probably be around $40 when you buy it on Amazon. So totally fair price for what you get.
I might actually get that. I would like to have like Road Warrior also.
I will definitely get that, because I actually haven't seen the original films, and you'll get all of them in Blu-ray quality and all that, so that'll be great.
Man, Beyond Thunderdome is a fucking movie.
Like
Road Warrior is the best one of those three. Beyond Thunderdome is a fucking movie, man.
Yeah. No, I'm excited. So it's called the High Octane Collection. Normally I don't announce like home video stuff on this podcast, but this is just one I've been so excited for. And just, you know, I do have Fury Road on Blu-ray because I think I got it for like $5 on Black Friday. But I've never watched it because I wound up seeing it several times in the theater and I haven't wanted to watch it at home yet. But this will get me to watch it at home probably a couple times because I just love black and white.
Yeah.
And this seems... Like, you know, I was watching a movie in black and white the other day and I was tweeting about this a little bit, how much I love black and white. And part of it is just that you see things so differently when there isn't color. Color can actually be a significant distraction to things like texture and detail.
Yeah, if you don't understand what color is doing to the image, it can be, like, completely undigestible.
Yeah. So, you know, black and white just draws your attention to different things, and I think in a movie as visually rich as Mad Max, and one where the director specifically went into it with color and black and white in his mind...
Yeah.
This will be a really cool presentation. So
yeah, I'm really excited to see that version of it.
Yeah. And again, it's nice that they're doing it with a box set with everything, or you can just get the movie individually. Totally a best of both worlds approach.
But if you haven't seen those old Mad Max movies, like the original Mad Max is kind of awkward because it's old and it, you know, had a very low budget and stuff. But Road Warrior is awesome. Beyond Thunderdome is something. So, like, if you haven't seen those movies, like, they are well worth going back and watching, in my opinion.
And, hey, this is the year of Mel Gibson. He's coming back with his first movie in 10 years, Hacksaw Ridge, which apparently is pretty good. War movie he directed. He's not in it, but he directed it. Yeah. The last movie he directed was Apocalypto.
That was little, like 2004 or something?
2006. So it's been exactly 10 years. Little trivia for you. People probably don't remember Apocalypto. It has come to have quite the cult following, though, which I don't quite understand because I saw it and it was okay. But, oh well.
Anyway. Yeah, I never saw that one.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've heard it's, you know, it's if you like violent movies, you probably like Mel Gibson, Passion of the Christ, Apocalypto, and now a movie about World War II, which was a famously violent war.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's good stuff. But let's go ahead and move on. Other piece of movie news, Shin Godzilla.
Yes.
Shin Godzilla.
Undoubtedly the best movie of the series. I haven't seen it yet, but it has to be, right?
Maybe.
By default.
Maybe. We announced, or we didn't announce, but we talked about the news last week that, a couple weeks ago, Funimation Films has acquired it. It'll have a theatrical run later this, in October, I guess.
Yes, October 11th to the 18th.
And they finally put the tickets on sale so we know where it's going to be here in Denver. And if you live in Denver, it's at the C Film Center, formerly the Denver Film Center. That's the home of the Denver Film Society. Easily one of my five favorite theaters in Denver, and I've been to all of them. It's a great theater. It'll be a great place to see that movie. I actually saw the original Godzilla there at a revival screening a few years ago, so this will be nice and full circle.
Yeah.
But beautiful theater, and they're good to support because they're a nonprofit that does a bunch of great film stuff here in Denver. So while you're at it, get a membership and stuff like that. They are worth plugging. They're a great theater. They're down on Colfax, lots of other cool stuff around there, so good theater. It'll be a nice time to go there. And then it's also at the Landmark Greenwood Village Theater, which is more out of my way, so I won't be going to see it there. But it's at these two theaters. You can get your tickets now. It's basically one showing per day in that period, October 11th to 18th. You excited, Sean?
Oh, fucking dude. Like, I've had this weird, awkward several months of my life where my, like, very core identity has been shattered of, like, the guy who has seen every released theatrical Godzilla movie, and now, finally, I can become whole again. And, like, and, you know, but even, like, just kind of joking aside, the stuff that's been coming out of Japan since this movie came out over there, and it's been hugely financially successful over there, and just critically praised by everybody, just, I'm so excited to watch this movie. It sounds so fascinating. It sounds like it's such an interesting take on Godzilla, and, like, what to do with a Godzilla movie. It sounds very different from your normal Godzilla movie, which, like, you know, I've been working on a list of my favorite Godzilla movies that I think because I'm an idiot, I think I might just rank all of them.
Do it!
I'm going to have to figure out how we're going to release that, because I don't know how much I'm going to write about the other ones.
You can do, like, a sentence, it's fine.
Yeah, so I will at least rank all the other ones, although anyone below, like, 15, I'm not going to commit to that being, like, a hard science-type ranking the way I will for all the other ones, which are the definitive ranking of the movies, and anyone who disagrees with me is wrong. Some of those, I'm not going to fucking rewatch Godzilla's Revenge. I'm not going to rewatch Godzilla vs. the Sea Monster. Those movies are fucking terrible. But, like,
no, I have seen a draft of your list, and it's very cool.
Yeah,
so.
but when you see that list, I think people will see that, like, so most of my favorite Godzilla movies are the ones that kind of go against a lot of the trends and do something very different, are very unique in their own right, and have a very different perspective on Godzilla, and bring something of, like, the director or so, or whoever, like the screenwriter, someone that worked on it, bring something of themselves and their creativity to Godzilla and that, like, type of movie. That's what gets me really interested in these movies, and those are the ones I love the most. And this sounds like absolutely one of those. So
I'm
really excited for this.
It's going to be fun. We will have a blowout podcast on that.
Yeah.
We'll record it live from the theater.
Wait. Sure, yeah. We'll just do a live commentary, like, fuck all the other people in the theater. And holy, it's going to be hard to watch a Japanese movie with subtitles while talking about it at the same time for the first time seeing it. But fuck it. Hopefully they don't throw us out.
I think they would.
The audio quality is going to be terrible.
All right. We're going to talk about the PS4 Pro announcement. But before we get to that, the same day, earlier in the day, Apple had their iPhone unveiling.
Yeah.
And there were a couple interesting things out of that. They announced the iPhone 7, obviously, and we can talk about that a little bit if we want. But I think the main thing for this podcast that was kind of interesting was not only did they announce a new Mario game for the iPhone, which will be coming out later this year, and it's called Super Mario Run, and it's sort of a free runner, but not, it's got levels. It's not.
Yeah, it's not an endless runner, but it is like Mario runs on his own, and you tap to jump and stuff.
It really does look like, if you're going to put a Mario game out on a phone, that's kind of the perfect way to do it.
Sure, yeah.
So it looks kind of cool. It's sort of in the next step in Nintendo's. They've done Miitomo, and they've done Pokemon Go, and now they're releasing something that looks like a real game.
Yeah.
So, anyway. But not only did they announce that, they got fucking Shigeru Miyamoto out on stage.
Yeah.
To talk about it, first in Japanese, or in English,
yeah.
English, and then he did in Japanese with someone translating. And as always, Miyamoto is just awesome.
Yeah, he's just like, it's like a little bundle of joy every time you see him. Like, it's just, you can't help but look at that man and be happy inside, in like your soul.
Because he's happy.
Yeah,
he's
exactly. Talking about how he's so, like, just effusive with it. It's just like, spews forth from him through the stream into your heart.
Yep. I mean, and I watched this the Apple conference live, and actually it took them so fucking long to get to the iPhone 7 that I only saw about 20 minutes of the iPhone 7 stuff.
The only thing I actually watched was the Shigeru Miyamoto stuff. Yeah. Like, I only, like, picked up the news of all the other
I just didn't know they would have so much other bullshit to talk about before. I just wanted to see the iPhone stuff, and it took them forever to get to it. I just had it on the background while I was working, so I wasn't suffering or anything, but it was still like, oh, God. But when they got to Miyamoto on stage, I was so surprised, because it's like, he doesn't come out all that much for Nintendo anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and then, like, Apple, like, spent so much of their, like, early days with the iPhone trying to distance it so much from the video game stuff.
Yeah.
That's crazy to have fucking Nintendo out on the Apple stage.
Yeah, but it was cool, and I'm looking forward to that game. They even specifically said it's not free to play. You'll just buy it. It'll probably be like $5-$10, and then you'll just play
it. Well, it sounds like it's free, but then like level packs and stuff like that will be purchasable, and you like the full version of the game will be like $5 or something.
Okay,
like Nintendo has done that with some of their 3DS releases, and other iPhone games have done that.
And that's the way to do it with mobile. To me, I don't like the free to play stuff, but I do.
Yeah, because they just gouge you for their prices, and like you hit this point in the game where it's like, hey, you unlock the opportunity to buy this special $250 pack that gets you three characters. It's like, fuck you, I'm deleting this game and never looking at it again, you fucking con artist.
My favorite part of Miyamoto's presentation was he was talking about how you can play the game one-handed. And he said, so you can do all these other things. And he listed some stuff. And then he said, or eating a hamburger. And then he did like the paku paku, like the onomatopoeia of eating a hamburger. It was very funny.
Yeah.
So, as you say, absolute bundle of joy. That'll be fun.
I'm looking forward to playing that game while eating a delicious hamburger.
Absolutely. I think we're all going to just have to do that in service to Miyamoto-san.
Yeah, I mean, he said it. I have to do it now.
Absolutely. So that looks like fun. So gaming news out of an iPhone event. That was surprising. And then the iPhone 7 itself was announced.
And they're taking out the fucking headphone jack, Jonathan. What the fuck is going on? That's like half of what I use my goddamn phone for.
It's like three quarters of what I use my phone for. I'll say this. You know, this was not a surprise. This leak.
Yeah, it's been. But like, a part of me, like, it's just, I knew they were going to say it because it's been rumored forever. But like, part of me just didn't believe that they would do that because fuck, why would you fucking do that, guys?
Yeah, I don't think it's the end of the world. I can live with it. I'll say this. I don't like the argument people are making. I'll say this. I think people are too far in one direction on either side. But on the side of, like, it's fine, I don't like the argument that this is like other times Apple has taken out ports. I think that's a false equivalency.
Yeah.
I think in the Steve Jobs era, when he would take out a floppy drive or a CD port or a USB port or something like that, I feel like sometimes it could be a little inconvenient, but you saw why he was doing it.
Right.
Very clearly. And I think you didn't need the floppy drive to do basic things.
Yeah.
And even on post-Jobs thing that Apple has done, the most recent thing they call the MacBook, the really thin little one, the 12-inch one, they took out basic USB and just have USB-C on there. And that's a little inconvenient, but USB-C is a new standard that everyone will be using at some point.
Yeah.
So that one, and it's also got a headphone jack on it, but like having USB-C in there, that I think they probably did it a little too early. But that does fall within their general philosophy, which is not just tearing shit out. It's doing it with a clear view on where the future is headed.
Yeah.
And yes, one day we will not use the 3.5mm headphone jack.
Sure.
But we are so much further away from that than we were when Steve Jobs took out the floppy drive or something like that. And I have to imagine, knowing the lover of music Steve Jobs was, he's rolling in his grave looking at this. Not just that they took it out, but that the solutions are so adapter-based, which he hated that kind of shit. That is so un-Apple to have a dongle hanging out of your phone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like if the next iPhone had a stylus.
Right.
And they actually do have a stylus. They have a stylus with their iPad. He would hate that shit. And I'm not saying everything they do has to be Jobsian, but he had a pretty smart view on this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. When he did, for instance, the original Mac, the one that was a failure.
Yeah.
Because the Mac now big hit, but the first Mac he made was a failure, and it was a fairly humbling experience for him because he wanted it to be 100% proprietary, and that's part of why it failed. And since then, while Apple likes their proprietary stuff, they've never actually had a 100% proprietary device.
Yeah.
This will be their first version of that completely walled garden. It's only got the Apple proprietary Lightning port. And that is annoying. And, you know, they've got the adapter. They'll have the headphones. I really just use my default Apple headphones anyway. I'll make it work. But the annoying thing really does come down to that the 3.5mm headphone jack is far more ubiquitous than any other piece of technology Apple has ever ripped out of something.
Yeah.
There are 3.5 millimeter jacks in everything, and including in other Apple products probably going forward. I really can't see how they would rip that out of the Mac, for instance, because right. that's just a basic thing you need for computing. And the rest of the industry is not going to go along with that. And, you know, they're talking about wireless headphones and stuff, and that's great, but wireless headphones are shit.
Yeah, like you're going to fucking lose your connection to them. You have to charge them separately. Like it, like they can be useful in specific scenarios, but by and large, having physical wired earbuds or headphones is by far the superior option.
Always, always, and that is definitely what is annoying about this. So
then, plus, like what they're also telling me is basically, okay, we're going to make it so that you have to put in one of our adapters into this Lightning port. Which is the exact fucking thing that broke a year after I got my last phone that made it almost impossible to charge that forced me to get the phone I have now. So it's like, no, fuck your Lightning port. Fuck your stupid little, like, cable thing that's going to break. Like, fuck your stupid adapter. No, the fucking cable, like, the audio cable jack has worked for decades at this point. I have a bunch of stuff like speakers and earbuds and stuff that use that. I'm not going to buy a phone that can't use that stuff. Because half of what I use my phone for is, like, listening to podcasts and music while I work out and that kind of stuff. Like, what the fuck? What are they thinking? To make the phone a little bit thinner? Like, it's more than thin enough. It's fine.
To play devil's advocate.
Yeah.
The reason for this was not about making the phone thinner. They're putting specific haptic feedback stuff in the phone that was where the 3.5 millimeter jack was. They couldn't fit it in anymore with what they wanted to add, and that's in addition to the camera stuff. Now, could they maybe have found a different place on the phone to put the headphone jack? I'm not a designer.
Right.
I would say maybe, probably. Especially because, again, the phone is actually... You have an iPhone 6.
Yeah.
Or S, they're the same thing. Yeah. I have a 6S Plus. The 7 and the 7 Plus are the exact same form factor in terms of width and everything. The only difference is they're slightly lighter, but they're the exact same thickness and height and all that. So that didn't change.
Wait, so they're fucking pulling out for complete bullshit then? They're not.
Well, again, not complete bullshit. They showed where it is that they had to put the stuff. But, I don't like it. I'm just... And I do understand... I am sympathetic to iPhone engineers who have to keep adding more stuff and make it thinner while keeping around an old technology that is, you know, not made necessarily for the way we put stuff together today. I do sympathize with that need.
Yeah.
I don't think this is the best solution.
No, like, the solution is to come up with a better thing. Like, not to just throw it out and be like, well, fuck it. Like, I guess Bluetooth sort of works sometime. Bluetooth on my phone is a bit spotty.
Just the biggest thing is that, you know, one of the original rumors also was that they would introduce some kind of wireless charging with this, because then you could charge your phone and listen to headphones at the same time,
right.
Which as it stands, you can't do, because it's only got one Lightning port. They didn't introduce wireless charging, and to me, the answer then is put a second Lightning port on that thing.
Sure.
That at least alleviates it somewhat, that you could do both things. You know, maybe one is only for audio and one's for charging, but just something like that, if you could. But... You know, it's there's a lot of things about it that are a little user hostile. You know, if you look at the stats, most people who use an iPhone just use the package in headphones. That's why they can do this and get away with it. It's annoying to a lot of us. I don't love it. But
hey, fucking goddamn it! It's annoying. It made me so angry.
It's very annoying.
It made me so angry.
It's very annoying because it's annoying because I otherwise love my iPhone. I don't like Android at all. I'm going to stick with iPhone. I'm going to have to get used to it when I upgrade. Yeah. But, you know.
Like, I would, like, it's like if they're going to rip something out, like, take the fucking speakers out of the phone. I don't need the speakers. I would much rather they have, like, rip the speakers out of the phone and keep the headphone jack than the other way around.
Probably. Although I do use just the onboard speakers a lot, and they've improved those. So that's nice, but, you know, we'll see. I'll probably be getting an iPhone 7 at the end of the year because I have an upgrade then, and we'll see. But... It's annoying.
Fuck them.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
PS4 Pro.
That's going to have a fucking headphone jack in it, goddammit.
It was kind of funny to me that we had this day of tech announcements, and both were pretty tepidly received by the public.
Yeah.
Like, very tepidly received.
Yeah.
Because the iPhone 7 has a lot of cool stuff, but then there's the headphone jack issue. And also, we didn't even make fun of them for the courage bit.
Yeah.
But just, they presented it in such a hubristic way that even for Apple felt out of character in how much hubris they were putting into that.
It felt like they knew they were fucking up, but they were like had to try to justify it somehow. It didn't feel like it had real conviction behind it.
No. Yeah. I mean, and it was too bad because Phil Spencer's a smart guy and that was a stupid thing to say.
Right.
And it was unfortunate. So, but the PS4 Pro announcement, so we had Andrew Young on stage first.
Andrew House.
Why do I say Andrew Young? I don't know why.
I don't know.
I always say that as his name, but it's Andrew House, the president of PlayStation.
Yeah.
He introduced it, and then it was Mark Cerny giving the majority
Mark Cerny
of the talk.
Fucking, like, came out of his, like, Zen cave in the Himalayas.
Basically did an ASMR review of the PS4
like,
Pro.
He should just, like, do every audiobook or something. Like, he has the most soothing, relaxing voice, even when he is talking about, like, the most technical shit. That's like, whenever anyone else in the video game industry talks about something technical, I completely, like, turn off inside. When he does it, I'm just like, oh, really? Thank you, Mark. That's very interesting. Like, if there's something about, like, I feel like his like consciousness transcends normal, like our normal reality. Like, I feel like from he's like Dr. Manhattan or something. Like, from his perspective, he was giving that speech about the PS4 Pro, and at the same time that he was giving the speech, like announcing the original PlayStation 4. It's just like, time is just a linear series of events, and I can travel along that line however I wish.
Well, anyway, let's set the stage for this. So we've known for months that the PS4 Neo was going to be a thing.
Yeah, it leaked in April.
It leaked in April, but Sony never really commented on it. Andrew House did a brief statement where he just said, it's going to be a more powerful PS4 that sits aside and complements. He even said the same line at the start of this conference.
Yeah.
Complements the main PS4. But that's all we'd heard. And so it had snowballed into different kinds of hype and confusion and mystery for months and months and months.
Yeah.
And to me, the most striking thing about this presentation is that we came out of it knowing roughly exactly what we knew before.
Yeah, yeah.
And people were really no less confused. And we will talk about the specific product, what it is, what it isn't, all of that stuff.
Right.
But it was frustrating on that level of how, because I do think Sony has a PR problem. I think we saw that with the PS4 Slim, that it was out and being reviewed and they would not confirm the fucking thing existed.
Right.
And they finally did. And they're just, they seem a little bit just immovable in how they react to public hype and the narrative and being unable to control their own narrative of this stuff, which they were very good at a year or two ago with introducing the PS4. And this year they've seemed to lose it a little bit. And this was not heartening on that level, that I did not come out of this feeling like I knew what this thing was for, really what they were pitching it as, what they saw it as. I don't think it had all that much clarity, and clearly I'm not alone in that.
Yeah.
So,
but like, we had like a small conversation on Twitter about this afterwards. Like, because it's something where I feel like I had a kind of, like, I don't think the event was particularly well done. But, like, it almost came away from a feeling like, they just shouldn't have even done the event. Because at some point, what's the point? Like, I can't watch a fucking stream at home and, like, see your, like, HDR stuff. Like, you can't watch this on an iPhone and, like, see the what difference 4K resolution makes. Like, that's literally physically impossible. Like, it only matters to the people who were at the event. Like they had a small, it was, like, a small press-focused event in New York. Like, it was not like crowds of fans and stuff weren't there. It was like a 30-minute long short presentation. Like, I feel like they just kind of shouldn't have done that and just did like a press release and let video game websites handle it and like maybe get like a more mainstream thing there to give it for like the more mainstream audience and get the message out there that way. But like I did come out of the presentation even feeling like it was kind of messily done and weird with like, I felt like everything finally made sense. Like, I felt like, okay, that's what these things are. And I feel like we'll see if Microsoft tries a different strategy with the Scorpio, and we'll like sort of speculate on that stuff later. But like the way Sony sort of pitched it and the way of like they talked about 4K and HDR and all of that, it made sense to me of like, this is not breaking the console cycle in the way that like I think a lot of people thought it was going to be because of how like Phil Spencer talked about it at that I think he talked about it at GDC or somewhere like that before all the rumors started that got the whole conversation swept up of like, oh, like we're talking about like maybe like the consoles will have an iPhone style sort of cycle, tech cycle and stuff like that. And then we found out, oh, there are rumors that Microsoft is actually working on a product like that. And now there are rumors that Sony's also working on that. And now we know that Sony's working on that. And it was like, all took this life of like, oh, you know, we had a whole long podcast discussion about, is this the death of the console life cycle? Is this the death of, like, that sort of business idea of how that works? And instead, we're going to adopt a more iPhone-like thing of where it's just the PlayStation, and then it's like a new one comes out every other year that is a little bit better. And then eventually, on like the PlayStation 5.0, PlayStation 2.0 games, or like the PlayStation 2.0 will be able to play 5.0 games and stuff like that. The way the iPhone tech stuff works. And I felt coming out of this, it made me realize that's not what it is. This is them just releasing a product because 4K TVs are going to become standard in the next few years of what new people buying new TVs are going to get. And so they're just going to have a console on the market that takes advantage of that. And that's what the Scorpio is going to be. That's like, that's what the market for this game is. And that, like, it all made sense to me all of a sudden. That it's like, this time around, unlike with the HDTV thing, the console cycle and the TV cycle just weren't lined up. So halfway through the console cycle, we release a slightly more powerful console that is designed to take advantage of the features that a 4K TV can do. And it will have some benefits if you don't have a 4K TV, but it is really for people who have a 4K TV to get to buy this console.
I agree with some of that. I think it's an oversimplification in some ways. And
but I guess that was like my takeaway.
No, and I get it. And that, if I'm not mistaken, that was my first theory that I voiced on this podcast when it was first announced, that that's all it was going to be. And really, that's all it is, sort of. There are still things that confuse me, even if you look at it through that framework. For instance, and I know people are harping on this, and I'm going to have to harp on it too, because it's unbelievably confusing. This thing does not play 4K Blu-rays.
Yeah.
And that is, by far, the easiest and cleanest way to see 4K content on a 4K TV.
Right.
Because 4K streaming is so not there yet. You know, you're not going to be able to download 4K stuff to this. And, you know, they're going to have a couple of apps, but even then that's not as built out as what some other consoles are doing and whatnot. So, you know, and it's also, it's a power jump in the system.
Yeah.
But it's fairly modest, and the main thing is to deliver that HDR stuff, which...
Well, I mean, the HDR stuff doesn't require huge power boosts. Like, it's the increase in resolution that's where the power needs to go.
Yes, but let's back up for a second.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to define some of these terms. Yeah. I want to define some of these terms. 4K TVs are a thing now, and I do not own one, but I do understand them.
Right.
And there's two things to a 4K TV. And there's the actual resolution, which is 4K, which means basically 4,000 lines of resolution across. It's horizontal. Right. 1080p TVs are 2K. They're 2,000 lines across. So 1920 by 1080. We say the 1080, that's vertical. 1080, yeah. 1920 is the horizontal. So about 2,000. 4K is about 39-something, or 3860, I think is what it is. So that's the resolution. But pretty much everyone agrees the resolution is far less important to 4K content, especially as it exists right now, than HDR. HDR is high dynamic range, and it's something that 4K TVs can do where they output a much wider gamut of color than you see on a 1080p TV.
Yeah.
And color gamuts and spaces and stuff is already becoming more of a thing. Different phones and tablets and computers do different things with color spaces, but this is an actual standard, and there's actually two warring versions of HDR at the moment. I forget the names. But we're kind of drifting towards one codec is what it seems. And certainly this is a Sony product that's using the one that Sony uses in the 4K Blu-ray discs and whatnot. And, you know, if you look at, for instance, reviews of 4K Blu-ray content, most movies these days that have been made in the last 10 years that are even made today, most of them are not mastered in 4K. It's really fucking expensive to do that with that many lines of resolution. Just like the vast majority of games you play on the PS4 Pro, they will not natively be in 4K.
Yeah, they're upscaled.
They're upscaled, but running something in that many lines of resolution is A, very difficult, and B, completely unnecessary. And that's part of my frustration with 4K TVs and stuff, is it's a jump we don't need because it's just the technology isn't there to drive it yet. Really, we're a few years. The TVs are ahead of the actual stuff for the TVs.
But that's how it always works. Like, that's how HDTV worked back in the day.
But there was already 1080. People have been shooting and protecting for 1080p for years before 1080p TVs were on the market.
But I mean, for like the consumer, from the consumer perspective, like, there wasn't, when HDTVs first became a thing, there was not a lot out that took advantage of it.
I do feel like we've jumped into 4K faster. They've come down in price faster. They've gotten on the market faster. There's more of them out there by different manufacturers. You know, I mean, people, when HDTVs first came out, they were tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And 4K was for like a month, and now you can get one for like $300. It hasn't been that long, is all I'm saying. But what I was going back to with like 4K Blu-rays and content is that the actual 4K resolution, there's not a lot of stuff you're going to see in actual native 4K resolution. It's starting to happen, but it's pretty slow.
Yeah.
The HDR is actually much, 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 much more important in terms of changing how things look and are affected. And it's what developers are more excited for with the PS4 Pro and the Scorpio and the Xbox One S and all that. Those wider color spaces matter a lot more. So with that in mind, if you're really trying to make a product work for a 4K TV, HDR is what you need most.
Yeah.
And so that's part of my confusion about how they're branding this, because they're somehow bringing HDR into normal PS4s with a patch.
Yeah, which I think that was in that firmware update, but I haven't seen any article on a website yet, like, sort of taking that and doing anything with
it. It's very confusing, because Sony gave very few details, and frankly, a lot of people are saying... I don't know in the PS4 Slim what they've changed, but the HDMI output on the basic PS4 shouldn't be fast enough to do
HDR. Yeah, that's like that's why I really wish that, like, I... Because obviously neither of us have fucking TVs that can take advantage of that shit. So it's like, I have no idea how that's working. If it's working, I don't know.
Yeah, so that's very strange, and it's weird that they kind of announced that at the same time, because it is such a confusing thing. But getting back to the whole 4K Blu-ray thing, that's where it gets confusing for me.
Right.
One, it's a fucking Sony product, and they don't have... Sony makes Blu-rays. Blu-ray is
but
owned by Sony.
But I don't think they make 4K
yes,
Blu-rays.
They do. Yes, they do.
I mean, I thought it was like a way bigger, like more companies were involved in it.
It's a bigger consortium because it's just... Sony
doesn't Microsoft also... aren't they also like in on it?
They're part of it, but that's true of any home media format. In that Sony did the initial development of Blu-ray, but there's an actual what's called the Blu-ray Consortium, which is a collection of companies. But the ultimate ownership of the brand is Sony. They're getting a bigger cut of that. If you imagine it as a pie of money, they're getting a bigger cut of that. It is their thing. It is their intellectual property. So that alone is confusing. And also just that you're pitching this as the thing for 4K TVs. Your competitor already has, at a lower price point, the Xbox One S, that plays natively 4K Blu-rays, and the PS4 Pro doesn't have that. And again, that is the easiest way to do 4K content now, and the internet stuff just isn't going to cut it for probably a few years still, in terms of showing actual 4K content that takes advantage of the most important thing, which is HDR, because that's the biggest thing that gets lost over streaming.
Yeah.
So, again, this is all... a little confusing to me. And then with the gaming stuff, like, it's very hard to show HDR over a stream, obviously.
I mean, you can't. There's literally nothing you can do to show anything about how... Like, the only thing you can show is that, like, well, look, this game has, like, some more foliage, and this game, like, runs at a better resolution than it did on the normal PS4. Like, that's all you can do. Like they showed some footage of, like, Shadow of Mordor, and over the stream was like, I guess that kind of more looks like what I've seen in the PC footage of that game, but, like...
But
you can't translate the resolution and HDR differences unless you're, like, you can't do it on the stream regardless. But, like, even if you downloaded a video version of it that was, like, this super fucking high, like, data-sized version of it, unless you had a monitor that could do that, you wouldn't be able to see it.
Right. So, and they said they were going to put out some of that content, so you could do something like that. I'm not sure how that manifested. But I was just a little confused coming out of that, because they talked sort of roughly equally about, here's the resolution stuff, here's the HDR stuff.
Yeah.
If you're tech savvy, you know the HDR stuff matters more. And yet, that's also apparently going to be on the other models of the PS4, plus the Pro doesn't do the Blu-ray stuff, which I know is niche, but it is still important if you're pitching, because that's in the aisles with the 4K TVs you're buying and stuff. This is Sony, it's their thing. All of that just felt a little muddied, because if the goal is, this is just the version you get with your 4K TV, some of it felt a little half-hearted to me on that level.
Yeah, I mean, it's something where, to me, because I also agree, like, the 4K Blu-ray one was the thing that, because that came out after the conference, because, I mean, they're not going to say on the conference, like, and we're not putting in a 4K Blu-ray player, but, like, that was...
Courage.
Exactly, like, fuck this format that we're invested in, like, who gives a shit? We're also taking out all the headphone jack on the controllers, because I guess that's where the future's going, and put a lightning port in there, I don't know if that's legal. But anyways, like, that came out after the presentation, and there was, like, a little bit of confusion for a while of, like, that seems crazy, why would they do that? And, like, I'm not sure if I agree with that choice, like, I have no idea, but to me, like, it's obviously, like, the most important part of the PS4 Pro announcement was that it came in at $400, because, like, What that does is, you know, the PS4 Slim is now at $300 before the base PS4 model had a price cut to $350. So now the PS4 Slim is $300. Now the PS4 Pro comes in at the original PS4 price of $400. And that, like, value choice makes a lot of sense. And that, like, that's part of the really powerful pitch of the console, I think, is that, like, it is, you know, it's not an insane upgrade, but it's also not an insanely expensive piece of kit. It's not that much more expensive than a normal PS4. If you're buying a PS4 and you don't have one yet, like, that's not a huge surplus to buy, because that would be, like, back in the day, that would be, like, the higher memory version of it. Or, like, if you're getting a phone, even though, like, the higher memory version of the phone might be, like, $100 more. Like, with that sort of pricing structure with technology, that $100, like, more premium version of the console, that's not that big of a price jump. It's like if they had done $450 or $500, that would be a much harder sell. And then also for someone like us, that if we ever, like, have, like, 4K TVs and want to get a PS4 Pro, you can sell your PS4 and get a PS4 Pro and stuff like that. So, like, that price thing makes sense. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that was, like, the thing they had to take out to get the price down. But to me, the thing it most feels like is that they just don't actually think that 4K Blu-ray is going to be an important format. That, like, physical media for movies and TV shows is just not significant enough for them to want to try to support it anymore. Is that's just what it sounds like to me at this point.
I can give you an alternate explanation from actual sources.
Okay.
Because I do understand that.
Yeah.
It baffles me a little bit because, again, it's Sony. It's,
right, right.
They, as a company, I can assure you, they do think it's a thing.
Because I mean, they have investment in it. Like, yeah. I said, it doesn't make complete sense, yeah. But that's what it sort of reads like to me.
Apparently. This was reported on the Digital Bits, and they would know what they're talking about. They're, like, the oldest website out there for, like, home media stuff. Bill Hunt is an expert on this. His sources tell him that in the years since the PS3 was created, with a lot of integration with Blu-ray, and, like, that was right. The big thing, Sony, like, home entertainment, like, that R&D side, and the PlayStation brand have actually grown very apart in a corporate sense,
right.
And are even somewhat competitive. And the Sony, whoever, what part of Sony makes the Blu-ray stuff, actually directly said they don't want it in there, in the PS4 Pro, because they don't want it competing with the Sony 4K Blu-ray player. Mm. That makes very little sense to me.
Yeah, no.
The other thing Bill Hunt noted, and if this is true, it's so crazy, I don't even know what to do with it, is that the actual technology in a 4K Blu-ray player is it is not expensive. It's very similar. That's why they've come out at such low price points.
Right.
It's very similar to a Blu-ray player. The actual tray and the laser and all that. And they could feasibly do it with a firmware update at some point. They could add it in once the other division is okay with it.
Huh.
If that's true, Sony as a company needs to figure their shit out, because that's right, a corporate. Yeah. That's a corporate cluster.
That sounds crazy.
And if that's true about the PS4 Pro, that's also just muddled in some ways, because right. If you can do it, you should just have it in and announce it.
Yeah.
The big thing to me that does confuse me is that, you know, the sources were saying they were going to announce this thing at E3. They decided to delay it, in part, I think, because they realized, well, Microsoft's going to show their hand. Let's hold back and see if there's anything we have to change.
Yeah.
And it sounds like they probably didn't, because the Xbox One S is now out, and yeah. It has HDR.
Yeah.
It has 4K streaming. It has 4K Blu-ray. It has everything the PS4 Pro does on that sort of 4K media level, plus a lot more. That 4K Blu-ray thing is a pretty substantial thing. At $299, yeah. The Xbox One S is by far the cheapest 4K Blu-ray player on the market. And the only thing the Xbox One S lacks, then, is that extra power to make the games look nicer, but it also does have the HDR for the games.
Right.
So I just think on a competition level, it does feel like Sony maybe being a little cocky on some level, saying, we're going to do our big thing, and it's not even going to do quite as much as our competitor's slim version. That's very strange to me. And I'm not saying they have to do exactly what the Xbox does, but there's a couple of things where it really has felt in the last few years like Xbox is fighting and fighting and fighting like hell yeah. To catch up and doing new and innovative stuff all the time. And the PS4 is, it doesn't really need to innovate in a lot of ways, because it's just a very, very well done console. I love
yeah,
my PS4.
Yeah, and they're the leader in the market right now, so they don't have the motivation.
But some innovation would be nice, because if you don't keep moving, eventually you will sag. And this does not feel innovative to me. Right. There's, you know, if you look at the number of things that Xbox is starting to pile ahead of them, they're going to have the 4K Blu-ray. They already have more in terms of 4K stuff on their consoles. They have backwards compatibility stuff. All these things that just, the trickle starts adding up is all I'm saying. Yeah. And that's where it starts feeling awkward, like, are they unaware of this? Are they not thinking of that? where do these decisions come from on some level, especially if we say, this is what the PS4 Pro is for, well, but it's lacking in, you know, this, this, and this.
Right, right.
And then you're a little confused. So, you know, I do get the price point argument. The Xbox is doing it at $299. Sony has this stuff. They could make it cheaper than anyone anyway because it's their stuff. I'm a little confused. By no means do I think it looks like a piece of shit product because of that or anything. If you don't care about physical media, obviously it doesn't matter to you.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people probably do, especially early investors in 4K, who could help get word of mouth out about this thing.
Right.
So that's where the confusion enters for me.
Yeah, for me, like, the play that I feel Sony is making here is more like, you know, because, like, obviously 4K TVs are just now starting to become affordable. Like, it's just now starting to become a thing. They released the PS4 Pro at $400, and I think, like, the way I see it is that, like, think about, like, 3 years from now, if, like, I get a 4K TV then the PS4 Pro will be, like, $300 or whatever, because it's been three, like, if you just take, like, how the price drops have worked for the PlayStation brand so far, and at that point, when you have, like, all of your existing games on the PlayStation library, like, the vast majority of them at that point would all have substantial of, like, graphical upgrades on the PS4 Pro version of the console. At that point, like, that equation makes sense to me when you think about you already have these 40 million built-in users. You're going to keep on growing the base. Like, a lot of them are probably going to start buying the Pro console just because it's not that much more expensive and it says Pro next to it, so it's the better one. As people start getting 4K TVs and want to get a device that is capable of doing something with it, you're just going to, like, eventually people, I think, are going to naturally upgrade as long as Sony is able to maintain their lead in the market. To me, that makes sense. Like, the biggest question marks are stuff like, is that, like, well, one, like, maybe who fucking knows if, like, there'll be a new model that can play 4K Blu-rays or they'll fucking do the firmware update if that's, like, actually possible. But, like, if they don't and it's is never able to play 4K Blu-rays, will that be a significant factor for a lot of people in that market? And then also, like, Microsoft's, like, competing console in the same space with the Scorpio, which will be more powerful. We, like, obviously know that, though we don't know how, like, the cost or anything else about that. Like, is that going to be able to, like, allow them to get that boost in the market and take the lead back from Sony, which is theoretically possible?
And honestly, that was my biggest feeling coming out of all this, is that I wouldn't say for sure anything that Xbox could take it back, but good God, if they have a moment to do it, this is it.
Yeah.
Because Sony just presented something that we thought would be kind of innovative, and it really isn't. And Microsoft has a big window because their current slim version already does more in some ways. And Scorpio next year will have that plus more. And yes, it'll be a year late to the party, but that might not matter if really they are doing the Steve Jobs thing and skating to where the puck's going to be, all right, of that stuff. You know, it's... You're talking about, you know, the Pro is kind of a future-proof kind of idea.
Yeah.
But then once the Scorpio enters, we'll see. And I think it's very possible the Scorpio is going to be pitched as something very different. If I had to bet, yeah, I think the Scorpio is more of a new console than this is. I think the Scorpio is going to be generation-breaking. I don't think this necessarily is. Well, obviously this is not. But yeah, I got to the end of that, you know, presentation and learned the information. It's like, well, Sony's probably fine, but they're kind of leaving a window open of not, they're not protected on this side and this side, and that's where it gets a little hazy. I mean, again, if you're going to buy your, let's say you're going to buy your 4K TV this Christmas, and you're going to have the PS4 Pro out there, and you're going to have the Xbox One S, and on some level, someone who is not educated in, like, the gaming improvements might just assume the Xbox One S does more and is $100 cheaper.
Right.
Depending on the model you get.
Yeah, I mean, like, that totally depends on if, like, the person buying it is way more interested in the media side of it or the video game side of it.
Yeah, and even the video game side of it, it says right there, you know, HDR games. The PS4 Pro will say HDR games.
Well, but, like, but the PS4 Pro, like, is a substantially more powerful console than the Xbox One.
Assuming people care about those things.
But, yeah, but, like, that's why I'm saying that, like, if you are interested in the video game side of it, you will care about those things, especially if they have... Because it's one of the things that, like... Obviously, because it's one of the things that's really frustrating about talking about it is that, like, neither of us can talk at all about how much better the games actually look because we have no fucking idea. You can't watch that stream and have any real idea. But, like, there's a really great article that Eurogamer, the Digital Foundry, that they do a lot of the tech stuff that they write for Eurogamer. They came out of that and wrote a really great article that they were actually incredibly impressed by the way it looked. Like, most of the articles I've seen from the press that were there are very impressed by how the games look, and that the resolution increase in the HDR stuff obviously makes a huge difference, and that just can't be communicated over a stream.
Right. And, you know, it really is about the HDR and the resolution. This is not about frame rate. It's really not going to smooth all that stuff out.
I mean, it could be. Like, there are, in the sense that they've talked about with several games, Tomb Raider and The Last of Us Remastered being too specifically of that there are, like, multiple modes that you can basically be in, depending on that. It's already a thing where, like, if you don't have a 4K TV, but you have a PS4 Pro, you can play, like, the 1080p 60 version of the game and stuff like that. And it seems most games are going to, like, have that as a setting you can activate, depending on, like, if, like, I imagine it will default to, if it detects, like, you sending a signal to a 4K TV, it will default to the 4K mode of the game. But you could theoretically play, like, The Last of Us Remastered in 1080p 60 as opposed to, like, 4K 30 or whatever, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but that's already a game that's in 1080p 60.
But, like, 1080p 60 with, like, all the fucking foliage and all that, like PC Ultra settings or whatever, you know?
Yes, but now we're coming back to visual effects again. I'm just saying, yeah. Like, you know, if you're someone who is super into frame rate, that's not the... that was not the focus of the pitch.
No.
Not that it has to be.
The resolution
saying,
stuff.
Yeah, so it's not that kind of thing. It's a much more... I'm not going to say, modest is maybe the wrong word, but it really is about, you're going to have a 4K TV to generally appreciate.
Yeah, it seems like while you will get benefits if you do not have a 4K TV, like, coming out of that presentation, I would not recommend buying this if you do not have a 4K TV. Yeah. Like, it just, the proposition doesn't make a lot of sense.
And we should back up. If you don't own a PS4 yet, get this one.
Yeah.
Like, it's future-proofed, it'll look better. It doesn't do anything less than the PS4 does. Yeah. They haven't stripped anything out, you know, or anything. There's more they could have added, and that would have been nice, and I think we all naturally expected. But this is unambiguously the better version of the console in terms of future-proofing. So, there's that.
But if you already have a PS4, like, they didn't make... And I feel like they didn't want to, but, like, they definitely didn't make a strong argument for you having to upgrade to this console. Like, I did not see that and feel like... No. I want to go out and get one of these things. But at the same time, like, there's actually a weird part of that that's really reassuring of, like, well, great, because my PS4 is still fine. Like,
yes.
Thank God my PS4 is still fine.
But this is the tough line they're walking the whole time that we've talked about before, of that if your PS4 is still fine, then the reason for this thing's existence seems less clear. If the reason for this thing's existence is more clear...
Except for the 4K part is what makes it make sense to me. Like, that's, like, the one part of, like, there's a new display technology.
You know, I get it.
This console does not take advantage of this new display technology. And it's like, imagine if, when high definition became a thing, if the console cycles were what they are now, where they have these long 10-year things instead of being 5 years. And, like, and if HDTV started becoming more of a standard in the middle of a console cycle... Then it starts to make sense of you want to have a product that takes advantage of that. That, like, even if you're not sort of, like, putting all of your eggs in that basket, and I feel like Sony is definitely not putting all their eggs in that basket, they're, like, putting a couple of eggs in that basket and being like, okay, well, our next console will be, like, serious in this regard, but we have a product out there that, people will get.
I get it. I still think it's tough to make the exact comparison because the jump from 1080p to 4K is in no way the jump from standard def to 1080p. Yeah. We are in really unprecedented territory here where TVs were just TVs forever. Then there was this massive jump to high definition.
Yeah.
And the industry went along with it because so much of the industry was just ready. It was a standard. There weren't these different color spaces and things that were confusing. And now we have this jump to 4K that is confusing in a lot of ways because there are still standards to be worked out. And there are things that are just, I don't think it's as unambiguous a leap in quality as the jump from standard def to high def.
But
things like
they're the only TVs on the market, particularly, like, or they will be in a couple of years, particularly if you're trying to get it at a specific size.
Sure. And
whether or not we need this upgrade, it is where the TV market's not going to go back. Like, there's no reason for them to. If they can sell these TVs in that, like, a price that is affordable for the wider market, like...
No, and certainly... 75% of my frustration with all of this is in the general TV market space.
Yeah.
Because it annoys me. I don't think we're ready to move on from 1080p. I don't think we need to move on from 1080p. This is not just me being paranoid. I think we're still improving in that space. And the 4K is an unnecessary jump that nobody is prepared for.
I mean, for God's sakes, like, the PS4 and the Xbox One do not run most of their games natively at 1080p. Like,
no,
I mean, the 360 and the PS3 didn't run a lot of their games natively at 720p, for God's sakes, you know?
Yeah, no, we're just not at that point, and it's this forced upgrade. And what very much worries me is that I think the next few years in TV stuff is going to be very volatile, because if you think they're just going to stop at 4K and leave it like that for 10 years, you're insane. There's already 8K TVs at the CES and stuff like that. And, you know, TV manufacturers have realized they can sell their stuff like they could sell iPhones, and it's becoming a very different industry where they're trying to push TVs in a way they've never been pushed before, and it's very consumer hostile. I think it's a house of cards that's going to come crashing down. And Sony and Microsoft are probably very, very smart to protect themselves and have their consoles ready for this. But I also think it's totally possible in 5 years, the standards could just be off and things are going to be weird and volatile. So that's where my worries are. And, you know, to me personally, I'm sure the HDR stuff is really cool. I'm sure it would be very cool to see. I am still just so amazed by what we're getting out of 1080p and the normal color space. Like, I was talking about playing Forza Horizon 3 earlier, and I tweeted this. It's like, this is why I have trouble, and I think so many people have trouble getting excited in HDR, is that 1080p in high definition is still a relatively new thing for most people. And I think we're still seeing what people can do with that, and now we're being asked to jump into this next thing. It is very fast. Now, I'm getting off topic. This is not Sony's fault. I'm not saying that. But it is. It's where, from a consumer mentality, it's really tough to figure out what to say or think about any of this. And I think it's going to be a difficult thing in terms of pitching the PS4 and the Scorpio and whatever comes next.
Yeah, so. It's just like, to me, like coming out of that conference, it was like it was not a sense of like, oh, the PS4 Pro is amazing. It's like, oh, okay, That's what it is. Like, okay, like it's just like, it's not a big deal. I feel like. Like, it just, like, all of this fucking crazy shit got wrapped up of, like, all, like, when the rumor mill started, when Phil Spencer had, like, his really ambiguous comments about, like, that I think he wasn't really trying to connect the iPhone thing to actually what they were trying to develop. It was just, like, him sort of speaking off the cuff, answering a question about, like, oh, maybe the console, like, maybe we need to rethink some of the console business stuff the next time around, and that kind of stuff. And that got wrapped into all of this. When it was like, I feel like the conversation really should have just been about 4K the entire time, and it was so much more tied to this evolution in display technology and not this, like, change in what consoles need to be, and that, like, the console style of video gaming is strong, it's still strong, and this is, like, in my tweet I compared it to, it's like the new Nintendo 3DS. It is this small upgrade, like, for the new Nintendo 3DS, I think it felt like that was more because they should have just had a second fucking analog stick on that thing in the first place. This is like, well, we need something that is there that is next to these 4K TVs that has 4K, like, somewhere on the box with, like, a logo on it. And then people will buy this and, like, have that shored up and will future-proof the console a little bit. But if you just have a PS4, it's fine. If you just have an Xbox One, it's fine. Like, the upgrades are not that insane. And unless you have this TV, you're not really going to take advantage of those upgrades either way.
Yeah. So, two things. Okay. One, I think that's probably all true. It is annoying to me that Sony has twice so far this year let the rumor mill get the hype so out of fucking whack. They need to control the narratives, because it's annoying just as a reader and following this, and it also just shoots them in the foot before they actually get out on stage and talk about the thing, because they are in no way in control of the conversation because they waited so goddamn long.
Yeah.
You know?
I feel like that's like a lot of... I feel like, because, like, a lot of, like, the No Man's Sky stuff kind of felt like that, too. And there have been other instances of where, like, I think Arkham Knight, when that, like, the PSC version of that was fucked. There was, like, a couple of weeks there where it's like, how come no one from this company is talking about this, like, controversy? You're just going out and, like, acknowledging it, even if they're not going to say anything specific about it. In the way that, at least, like, you know, with the PS4 Pro stuff, Andrew House at least had that statement of, like, yeah, we're doing something kind of like that. We'll talk about it. In the fall. And that, like, at least that was something. With the PS4 Slim, they're just like, nah. And there's nothing coming out of it. Like, it was just this clear, like, void in every, like, press release and everything like
that. And there was no reason in the world to let that go that way. There's no reason in the world to play it so close to the vest with this thing when it is what it is. This totally could have... I mean, their E3 presentation was in a very different mode, and it would have messed with that mojo, but at E3 there could have been something else where they talked about this.
Yeah.
Maybe not doing a full unveiling, but saying, here's the mission statement.
Yeah.
And that's what's missing from this, is all I'm saying, is that we have to sit here and kind of piece together what this thing is for, rather than clearly getting it out of their own literature and discussion. Yeah. And that's all that I'm annoyed about.
Yeah, I feel like it's just that one of those things of where, the way that people consume news and the way that like people like can, like people like us that are really invested consumers and in everything about in this product line, like the way we pay attention to it and the way that like you know the people in video game journalism get these rumors and stuff and get these leaks and get that out there, some companies just like for whatever reason don't catch up to like it's fine. Just fucking come out in front of it. All you have to do is come out in front of it. And it's fucking fine. It's like, you see this all the time with, like, video game leaks of where, you know, you find out that Assassin's Creed Syndicate is set in Victorian London 2 years before that game comes out because Kotaku has that story. And then you're supposed to be surprised that E3 was like, hey, guys, and the new Assassin's Creed is set in Victorian London, and we're very excited about what this setting is like. Yeah, I read the fucking... I saw the leaked footage, alpha gameplay footage of the dude with the grappling hook. You're not going to surprise me with the grappling hook. When this stuff gets out there, you just have to kind of say, okay, our PR marketing strategy, it has been pushed up a year, but we have to get out in front of this and talk about it a little bit.
It seems profoundly tone-deaf.
Yeah.
So a lot of people point this out, that when they announced the Slim at this show, they didn't even make an aside or a mention or anything about
how they didn't even make a joke, which it feels like that is the standard protocol.
Yeah.
We saw that at like E3 when... At this year's E3, EA's press conference got like totally leaked beforehand, and like the Titanfall 2 trailer stuff came out right beforehand, and the guy from Respawn Entertainment, I can't remember his name, came out on stage, and like he just made a fun joke about it, and was like, okay, great. Like, yeah. Be a human being. Acknowledge right. that, like, haha, there's already reviews of the PS4 Slim on multiple different tech sites, but now we're announcing it, you know?
And you have to do that because here's the thing. And I think this is kind of my last note on this.
Yeah.
You cannot be the market leader and also be completely tone deaf.
Yeah.
You can't be both at once. And it feels like Sony has been in the last year a little more tone deaf than they need to be. And they just need to kind of ramp that back up or else, man, and Microsoft has a lot of room to catch up.
Yeah.
Because of that tone deafness. That's all.
Yeah. Like when the conversation gets taken from you, you have to find a way to take it back in like...
Yeah.
Video game companies are very, very bad at that because their shit gets leaked all the fucking time.
Yeah. So my last point on this.
Okay.
And getting to some other speculative stuff. So you talked about how, you know, we're not breaking console generations. This is what we need to have this patchwork. So because of the 4K in the middle, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Totally agree with that for the PS4 Pro. The question is, I'm not so sure that's what the Scorpio is.
Yeah, because the Scorpio is like... If all the tech stuff that they released to be believed, it is substantially more powerful than the PS4 Pro.
Substantially more powerful. So that's A. B is the way Xbox people are just talking about it and that they've specifically used the phrases like, we're going to redefine what a generation is.
Yeah.
They're not being anywhere near as conservative on that. And then in terms of reports you hear from different journalists, for instance, Patrick Klepek, now at Vice Gaming, he talks on Twitter, he said, developers... pretty okay with the PS4 Pro. It's very... You kind of just flip some switches. It's
right,
some
yeah.
extra man hours, but it's not like something so radically different. And he said, the Scorpio, though, what I'm hearing is that sounds like it's a different console. And that actually does make sense because the Xbox One came out dramatically underpowered.
Yeah.
It has a lot of problems. Its own UI doesn't run well on it anymore. I have no interest in a PS4 Pro. I am absolutely excited for a more powerful Xbox One because it really needs it, and that console has a lot of potential... that is being held back a little bit by the fact that it can't get its shit together because of the stupid decisions they made early on when they were Kinect and multimedia focused.
Yeah.
And, you know, the PS4 does not need to reinvent itself. The Xbox kind of does, but in so doing that, they're going to have to break a little more than Sony is doing.
Yeah, like if that is true and like if the Scorpio is the Xbox 2 or whatever, like this next successor in the Xbox line, and that's, like, what they're going with, like, fucking, man, that would be nuts. Like...
I think it's going to be a little nuts. I think...
This is, like... It's never worked.
It's...
Like, the fucking history of video game consoles is paved with the carcasses of consoles that came out between video game console generations.
Yeah.
It is paved with Atari Jaguars and Sega Dreamcasts and fucking Wii U's, you know? Like, it's never fucking worked so far.
No. And maybe we're going to get a couple of these anyway. The NX is coming out mid-generation.
Yeah, I mean, Nintendo fucking went off the rails a long time ago. So.
Yes, but so that's going to happen. This could conceivably feel like its own console. And maybe Microsoft has room for that because, frankly, there's not all that many Xbox Ones out in the wild compared to their competition.
To PS4, yeah.
So maybe there's an opening for them to assert themselves more. But it could be a disaster. It could be exactly what they need. We're so far away, I don't know.
I'm really curious about what the price point is going to be, because if it is that much more powerful, like I feel like $400 has felt like it is kind of the sweet spot for consoles, and it has been for a long time. And like Xbox One launched with the base unit was like $500 because of with all the Kinect shit, and they did a great job getting that price down really fast by ripping the fucking Kinect and kicking it to the curb right away. But like, you know, I feel like a $500 console is a lot to ask for from a lot of people. It always kind of has been.
And my guess would be they're going to try to get this down to $400 because...
But can they reasonably? Like,
can they? Maybe not, but maybe that's why it's next year. They could probably...
Maybe, but like...
Because in a year, components could be cheaper and they could get it together.
I feel like they wouldn't make that big of a difference. Like it wouldn't be that much. I mean, if they are willing to take a significant like loss on each individual unit, like they technically can get the price down. Like the question is that really feasible for like how they're going to produce it?
Who knows? I think having the Xbox One S out this year at $299 does feel like that's part of the plan.
Right.
Because having a $200 gap between your console version sounds weird.
But if it is not Xbox One Pro, if it is Xbox One 2, then...
Yes.
Then it's like, well, who... Like, who knows what that price gap is? And then obviously, like, if it is... Like, I would assume, based on how they've been handling stuff... Even if it is like the like next generation of Xbox console, it will have to be backwards compatible, right? Like there's absolutely no way.
No, it'll be 100% backwards compatible. The question is forwards compatible.
Yeah.
Will new games be available on the base Xbox One? And I think they're going to have to start splitting that because, frankly, I can imagine a scenario where the Scorpio is out this year and ReCore comes out. And it runs the exact way it does right now on the base, which is janky. And on the Pro, on the Xbox One 2,
it's like it's super smooth 60 frames per second. Like, yeah.
I think we're going to see that. And that's where it gets... I don't think that's a danger on the PS4.
The way they're pitching it is that like it feels like the PS4 is PC on medium, PS4 Pro is PC on ultra. Like, it is a noticeable difference, especially if you have the higher resolution stuff. But, like, it's not insane. Like, it's... If you ever... Someone who's ever played a video game on a PC, you understand how that works. It's not a big deal. It is not like Xbox 360 to Xbox One or PS3 to PS4. Like, that's a way bigger jump.
Mm-hmm. So, who knows? But I feel like the fact that they're waiting another year, that...
It's that much more powerful.
It's that much more powerful, and that they need it more.
Yeah.
You know, and there's, again... I think they have wiggle room because I think Xbox One owners and the public will be more amenable to a bigger jump here than they would have been with the PS4 because there's far fewer owners and those owners are, with the PS4, completely satisfied.
Yeah.
With the Xbox One, I think most people think the way I do, which is it's got a lot of good stuff, but good God, it can be a fucking hassle to use.
Yeah.
And I think a power jump could fix so many of those issues if they could go back to square one, but does that just mess everything up?
Who knows? Like, it'll be really interesting to see next year. Like, we'll have... The NX will be all out in the open. Nintendo can finally stop doing their fucking thing of, like, every time they have an announcement, getting out a month in front of me, like, we're going to talk about some 3DS games, but we're not going to talk... Don't ask us about the NX! Like, we're not going to talk about the NX. Finally, Nintendo will stop that. We'll know what the NX is, and we'll start finding out what the Scorpio is. It's like, man, like... Like, it's just, it's never worked. Like, the mid-console thing. But, like, you know, that doesn't mean that it can't ever work. Like,
and here's the thing. I think if you're betting safe money, it still probably will be something like the Xbox One Pro. And it's just a little more pro than the PS4 is pro.
Yeah.
But
that could be one professional console.
But it could be what we're describing as the more extreme scenario. That's also a possibility.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think next year is going to be very interesting for consoles. I think the PS4 has the kind of lead and market penetration that it's going to be smooth sailing for a while. But there's going to be a lot of volatility with the new Xbox, with the NX, all that stuff. You know, Nintendo's probably fine because the Wii U has been such a non-factor for the generation so far.
Yeah.
I think the mid-generation launch, that alone is not going to hurt them. But, yeah, we'll see.
Nintendo's it's a special case, you know. Like, it has its games and its fans.
We shall see.
Yeah.
But let's go ahead and talk about some video game past.
Well, no, before we move on, I feel like there's one thing that happened at the PS4 Pro launch an announcement thing that we did not talk about, that I want to talk about. How the fuck is that the place where you show Mass Effect Andromeda, like, gameplay footage for the first time?
Because they're trying to hide it.
What the fuck was... Did you watch the...
I watched a little bit of it. It's so confusing.
I was kind of expecting it because there had been rumors that BioWare was going to be there with Mass Effect. It says, like, okay, I guess maybe it'll be there in clip of, like, and all of these games will be better on PS4 Pro, and you'll see a clip of, like, you know... you'll see a clip of, like, a guy talking into a camera with Mass Effect Andromeda behind him, which is, like, how we've seen most of Mass Effect Andromeda from EA so far.
No, but this was literally the first gameplay footage.
Yeah, this is the first meaningful gameplay footage, like, that is not just, like, part of a, like, documentary-style video package. It was, like, an extended gameplay sequence that consisted of a man running around in a cave... like jump packing from like on these like rocks, scanning a flower, then going and activating a cutscene where he looked at a star map and then he pressed a button and then everyone had to run away and that was it. It was like
I have to admit.
What the fuck? How did you win? If you had this like or something like this, why didn't EA just show it at E3 instead of having no fucking games to show at E3 other than fucking Madden and FIFA? Then, two, if you're going to show Mass Effect Andromeda, which is one of the most anticipated games of next year, if it fucking ever comes out next year, and is all, like the successor to one of the most beloved, financially successful, and popular franchises of the previous consoles, why is the first time you show it the most boring fucking thing that is so non-identifiable as a Mass Effect game? Like, you could have told me that that was anything, and I would have believed you until the Asari lady showed up. It's like... show me someone shoot a gun, show me a dialogue choice, show me a biotic power, show me the galaxy map, show me the fucking video game. Don't show me a guy just walking in a cave and activating a cutscene. That's nothing. What the fuck?
I'm officially worried about this game.
Me too, man.
I think they're clearly eons away from finishing it.
If this is all they have to show.
They have nothing to show. The place they're showing it is the fucking weird PS4 Pro launch.
PS4 Pro, like, announcement thing that was showed to, like, 100 press people and then, like, a small, like, people watching the stream.
They've basically talked about Mass Effect Andromeda either in the shadows or just full-on buried as it was here. And that's very worrisome for a game that was supposed to at some point come out this year. Probably will not come out next year. It could, you know, again, we had 3 Mass Effect games on the last console generation. Yeah. We may not even get one this time. Probably will get this one, but we're not going to have Mass Effect Andromeda 2 on the PS4. I can virtually guarantee that.
Yeah, like, it goes to show how what boring the demo was and two, how buried it was in the press conference that, like, you clearly forgot about it, and I only remembered it near the end of that conversation, so luckily I was able to bring it up. But what the fuck? How is that? How is this how you show off this game? How was this, like, not a better demo, and how was this not an E3? What the fuck is going on with Mass Effect Andromeda?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like some point very soon, a site like Kotaku or Eurogamer or someone is going to publish an expose of the Mass Effect Andromeda development is in chaos.
Yeah, like the stuff that came out about, like, Destiny, yes. You know, where you find out, like, oh, like, behind the scenes, the content pipeline for this entire game just got completely demolished, and the writing team left, and, like, we just never knew any of this stuff, and, like, the tell-all story about how Mass Effect Andromeda got fucked in the ass at some point.
Yeah, I have no idea. And again, I don't get worked up about it because while I love Mass Effect to death,
yeah,
I have so little need for more of it because it's 1, 2, 3, and it's perfect. You know, it's like... Right. Yeah,
one of the strongest video game trilogies for sure.
And one of the strongest endings, no matter what petitions say.
Yeah,
so
fuck those people.
But
the idea of Mass Effect Andromeda is so good. It's such the perfect idea for a new Mass Effect game of going to the Andromeda Galaxy and, like, starting a new story and with new characters and all that stuff. But, like, I want it to be so good, and the idea of a Mass Effect game on these consoles and everything is so enticing. Yeah. And I will say, the one thing I did read... Okay, there are 2 things I like about the demo. I liked when he scanned the plants, because I like scanning things. No Man's Sky has made me realize I just kind of like scanning stuff. I hope you can give stuff stupid names in Mass Effect Andromeda.
Play Metroid Prime.
Yeah.
Best scanner ever.
No Man's. Can you scan something and call it like Butt Monkey in Metroid Prime, and then every time you look at it, it says Butt Monkey on the screen?
No, but there's actual substance to the scanning in Metroid Prime.
Are you saying that naming something Butt Monkey is not a substantial act? Because I think it is the most substantial act.
It's great for half an hour.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to disagree on that. But this is the other thing, and perhaps the most impressive thing about Mass Effect Andromeda footage, was that the main character, Ryder, on his suit, he had these like two little like sort of like Velcro strap things on his butt, and the physics on those were really good. And kind of like weirdly, like it was just one of those things of like where cloth physics have come so far in video games that since the entire demo basically composed of a guy running around in a cave, I was just looking at those and being like, the physics on those straps are really nice. Those are some like you couldn't have done that shit on the 360. Those are some next gen straps on his butt.
So let's go back to a time when cloth physics in games was not so developed. Right. I'm gonna make this fucking transition.
Okay.
Anyway,
let's talk about the GameCube.
The GameCube. 15 years ago today, the GameCube launched in Japan. I got mine in like January, I think, of 2002. So it was few months after where we are now, 15 years ago. Because I did not get it for Christmas, or we did not get it for Christmas. We got it a few months after that. But we got our GameCube. The GameCube was not technically the first console I owned, but it was the first I substantially interacted with, because we had an N64 like a year or two before. Like, we got our N64, I'd say probably in 2000, like summer 2000 or something. Yeah. Or maybe not even like Christmas 99, and then we had it for 2 years, and then we got the GameCube. That's probably right.
Okay.
Because Smash Bros. Would have had to be out and all this stuff. But so I had the N64. I never played a ton of games on that. But when the GameCube came out, I mean, that was my primary console for that entire generation. We did have a PS2 at one point, but it was never the main thing I played games on. I was such a Nintendo person.
Right.
Like, even one of the fun things today, I realized this, and so I started looking through the list of GameCube games and making a list of my favorites and stuff. And I realized that was the last time Nintendo really was on parity with the competition. They got the third-party games. They had the cross-platform titles.
Yeah.
You could get, for instance, the DBZ games, the Madden games, all of that stuff. They were on the GameCube.
Yeah.
You know, Resident Evil 4 fucking launched on the GameCube. People forget that.
Yeah. That's... Although, like, and then Resident Evil 4, like, just last week launched on the PS4 and the Xbox One also. Like, that game has been on literally every single console.
But it was
GameCube it was GameCube first.
It was a GameCube exclusive for a year. It was a weird thing. So, and that just is so... That doesn't happen anymore, you know? So it's very... But I was very Nintendo-focused, those kind of first and second-party titles. And the GameCube had such an interesting life to me because it's one of Nintendo's weirdest consoles in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
In that it doesn't have classics in the way the N64 or the SNES or even the Wii has classics.
Yeah, like most of its classics like come with an asterisk next to it.
And not necessarily even in terms of quality,
but
with an asterisk in that this is more of a cult thing, or this never quite caught on, or this was like super experimental.
Like, even like some of them are not quite as good, or like, but the ones that are have that, like, they're really good, but they never like set the world on fire the way that Ocarina of Time and Super Mario 64, like Super Mario World, did.
Exactly. And yeah, and that's not to say some of these aren't as good. We're going to talk about Metroid Prime. Metroid Prime is one of the 10 best games ever made. I will fucking go to the mat for that, and a lot of other people will.
Sure.
But, like, even that's a game that did not cast the shadow that Ocarina of Time did, or that over on the PS2 and Xbox...
Or that Metroid did,
yes. Yeah,
like, Metroid defined an entire genre that somehow Castlevania wormed its way into that one. I still don't know how, like, that fucking worked. But then, people don't make games like Metroid Prime. That's one of the reasons why you like ReCore as much as you do.
Yeah. So, and people don't make games like GameCube games were. GameCube games could just be weird and experimental. And if you look at sort of some of the main entries, like Mario Kart Double Dash or something like
Double Dash.
They just did weird things with stuff, and it was part of the joy of the GameCube. It was a weird design. It was this little box with these little discs. It had a handle.
It's like your little lunchbox.
Yep. It had a weird controller. It had a weird C-stick. It had that glorious opening, my favorite console startup. We played it at the top. I love the GameCube startup. It's just a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's a weird console. And it's something where it's like, I always sort of, because I got the original Xbox not that long after the GameCube, I'd like not fucking remember like what years that would be. I would have gotten, like, I think the GameCube 2001, because I think we did get it for Christmas that year. And then I think we probably would have gotten the original Xbox maybe 2003. It was definitely before Halo 2 came out, but we didn't have the original Xbox for that long before the 360 came out. But my memories of that console generation is much more like Halo and Knights of the Old Republic, like, really dominating it for me, because, like, I loved those games so much. But I did have the GameCube first, and honestly, the game, because, you know, I was obviously, like, a Sega kid growing up with, because my brother had the Genesis, and I played a huge amount of the Genesis when I was a kid. Like, it was Sonic Adventure 2 Battle, yes, on the GameCube, and I was at my friend Jeff's house. Very specifically, I remember this. And they had the GameCube, and they were playing Sonic Adventure 2, and, like, I had only played a little bit of Sonic Adventure at my friend who had a Dreamcast house, and I was like, oh my fucking god. So, like, Sonic 3 was my favorite game, basically, at that point, like that in Ocarina of Time. But I loved Sonic characters so much. I love the cartoons. I love the character. I was like, I have to play Sonic Adventure 2. Look at this fucking shit. This shit is crazy. You see, like, City Escape is an awesome level. And just seeing that, I was like, I have to get this console.
Same way.
And, like, it was I was so fixated on it that, like, I even just wanted, because I knew, like, whether it was Christmas or maybe it was, like, my birthday or my brother's birthday, I don't remember when we got it. But I remember we had to wait, like, my parents said, like, we'll get it, but it will be, like, a birthday present, a Christmas present, something like that. I was like, well, can we at least buy the game? Can I have, like, the game? Can I look at, like, have the game and have, like, the manual or something? Like, I just want this thing so bad. Because, you know, like, capitalism, I just need it. I need to consume this, even if I can't consume it yet. But then, you know, eventually we got the GameCube. Sonic Adventure 2 Battle was the game that we got. I played the shit out of that game.
Oh, it's...
And then I played the shit out of it, and then I discovered the Chao Gardens, and then my life was changed forever, because the Chao Gardens are amazing.
I think it's amazing that Sonic Adventure 2, technically a Dreamcast game.
Yeah.
But if you were to say, that's one of the five best GameCube games, no one will ever argue, because it defined the GameCube even as a port.
Like, yeah, I think it definitely was for me.
And that's partially because the Dreamcast died so quick, and it probably never sold much on the Dreamcast.
Yeah.
But that is, to most people, a GameCube game. And then I think a lot of people, like me, Sonic was discovered through the GameCube, because Sonic Adventure 2 became a huge hit, so they released Sonic Adventure DX, and then they released all those collections, and so that's where I first played the original Genesis games and stuff, and all the spin-offs. Like, Sonic, in my mind, is really heavily tied into the GameCube.
Which is crazy, because it's a Nintendo console.
It is, but it also... Man, when you look back on it now, it speaks to how much Sega has kind of dropped the ball, because for those first few years after the GameCube, or after the Dreamcast failed, I think they very much thrived working on someone else's hardware.
Yeah.
Sonic made a really big impact on the GameCube, because they had Sonic Adventure 1 and 2, all the collections, Heroes came out there, Shadow the Hedgehog, like, you could get just about every Sonic game ever made on that thing at one point, and new ones were coming out. And most of those are pretty good. The only one in that list I would say is not good is Shadow the Hedgehog.
Yeah, Sonic Heroes is a bit questionable, but it's fine.
It's fine. It was a good game. I like that game. I've gone back and played it on the GameCube as recently as, like, last summer, and I like that game. So, yeah, I mean, I really cannot overstate how important the GameCube is to me as someone who plays and talks about and writes about video games in my development as someone who does that.
Right.
You know, overall as a child, the biggest consoles to me were the Game Boy and the Game Boy Advance and the DS, because I was really into handhelds. But in terms of home console stuff, it was the GameCube all the way for those years. And then I finally got my 360 a little after the 360 came out, because I wanted to play Halo 1 and 2.
Right.
Because I played that on a friend's Xbox, but we just waited until the 360 was out to get them. So, but for that generation, yeah, it was the GameCube for me. And I have so many fond memories. I still own most of my games, still have my GameCube. And the GameCube also, we should say, it did, as kind of weird a console as it was in some ways, it has cast a fairly long shadow for Nintendo because it was fully integrated into the Wii.
I mean, the Wii is... It's a GameCube with a sensor bar.
It is, in
terms of its technology.
Literally, anything you could do on the GameCube, you could do on the Wii except the Game Boy Player. Everything else was fully integrated into that, to the point where you opened up the thing on the top.
Yeah, put your memory cards in.
Put your memory cards, your controllers, all of that. Smash Bros. Brawl, the third one, everyone played that with GameCube controllers.
Yeah, who
thought? And the new Smash Bros., they even released GameCube controllers for the Wii U, just in case you wanted to play it that way.
Yeah, and that, like, brings me to, for the GameCube, like, the thing that the GameCube turned into me, because, like, you know, I played Super Mario Sunshine and I didn't like it. I played Wind Waker and I liked it, but didn't love it, because, like the, I think the latter part of that game gets really rough, and I'm, like, you know, that's the sort of, a lot of people think that. But, like, and then I liked Double Dash, but I never owned a Double Dash, because Double Dash was only fun when you played it with friends, so I just would play it at a friend's house. So, like, the GameCube eventually just turned into me the thing that you play Chao Garden on, and the thing that you play Super Smash Bros. Melee on, first and foremost, Super Smash Bros. Melee, because, holy fucking shit, Super Smash Bros. Melee is, like, one of the best games ever made.
It absolutely is.
It's, and it is, like, the one game that also makes me feel like, from almost any other game, the GameCube controller is kind of bullshit. The Super Smash Bros. Melee does not work on any other controller. Like,
yeah.
The GameCube controller has a bunch of weird shit, like the C-stick and the way that, like, the R and L triggers work, yeah. That, like, for, like, a first-person shooter or a third-person shooter is absolutely terrible. But, like, you know, if you need to use the C-stick to quickly swipe in a direction to do, I don't know, a smash attack in Super Smash Bros., that is, like, you couldn't use a normal functioning analog stick to do that. You have to use the weird, snappy, awkward, snubby, fucking stubby C-stick thing on the GameCube controller. That's the only one of those that would work for that. Or, like, you need the weird, like, double click-in kind of thing that the R&L buttons have, because that allows you to do, like, the shield and the roll and all that stuff with a greater sort of degree of accuracy. Whereas, like, you would normally want for, like, a racing game, that's really fucking annoying, because you want the full control of the, like, the full analog kind of control of a trigger. But for fucking Super Smash Bros. Melee, it's the perfect controller.
Yeah, no, and, I mean, Melee, absolutely one of the greatest games ever made, cast such a long shadow that fans sort of just rejected the follow-up Smash Bros.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the Wii U version, 13, 14 years later, that finally a new Smash Bros. Kind of supplanted it.
Yeah.
And Melee is still played in tournaments. You can still go back to it. It's a great game. And it is entirely possible that I have played Super Smash Bros. Melee more than any other game in my life. Just in if I were to count the hours. It is entirely possible.
It would definitely be up there for me.
And the new Smash Bros. Is getting up there too, because if I add up my 3DS and Wii U hours, it's like 200 at least.
Man.
But, you know, because it's an evergreen game I play by myself and with my brother and other people and stuff. So, but yeah, for a very long time it was Melee, and for a very long time, even when we had Brawl and Brawl's a really good game too, and it's got lots of good stuff about it, but there was a point where my brother and I just, when we wanted to play Smash, we went back to Melee.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it's funny, I've been working on kind of redoing my list of my top 10 favorite video games,
right.
And I'll hopefully have something to show you guys with that soon, because the project has kind of ballooned, and it's a fun, different thing. Smash Bros. Is in there in the top 10. I don't know how to qualify it. I think I'm just going to say it's Smash Bros. And you know what that means.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's an evolving thing. Really, my favorite of those is the most recent one. But it's just Smash Bros.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, because later on the list, I've kind of ranked it out to 50 titles at this point. And one of them is just, I had that with Mario Kart. And I'm like, it's just Mario Kart. Like,
yeah.
Mario Kart evolves. But Mario Kart is one of my favorite gaming experiences. But I Mario Kart 8 is probably the best, but I'm not going to discount my love of Double Dash and DS and even 64 way back in the day, you know, even if I'm not going to go back and play them necessarily.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But getting back on topic to the GameCube, so much cool stuff. Very interesting console. Did you ever have the Game Boy Player?
No.
I did, and it was, and I'm kind of sad. I sold it when we got our Wii, because I sold the GameCube to get the Wii, because no one ever thought you would need it. And I have since gone back, since I don't have a Wii anymore, because I got the Wii U, I did get a GameCube, so I just had, because I got it for like $20, you know. So I do have that, because I still had all my GameCube controllers and paraphernalia and whatnot. And I kind of wish I had still had my Game Boy Player, because that was an awesome way to play GBA games. Because it gave you lots of options, you could play your color games and all that, and your original Game Boy games. And it was just kind of cool and novel to see them on the TV. Because they had something like that on the SNES back in the day with the Super Game Boy. But the Game Boy Player was a much more fully functioned version of that. And it like snapped onto the bottom of the console. And it was like permanently affixed, so it became like a big Game Boy. It was neat.
Yeah.
So
that was like, I mean, that just kind of makes you think of Pokemon Stadium had the thing that you could play the original Pokemon, like Red, Blue, and Yellow on your TV. Which is always kind of weird.
Yeah, and you know, we should also talk about that. The GameCube did something that really people haven't tried all that much since, which is that they tried to have a lot of functionality between the Game Boy and the GameCube. There wasn't just the Game Boy player. There were cables that you would connect your Game Boy to the GameCube with, and that even was used in games like Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles or Legend of Zelda Four Swords Adventures, where it was like a fundamental part of the game. I never got super into that, but there were certain Pokemon experiences where, like, I remember when I bought Pokemon Colosseum, if you attached Pokemon Ruby or Sapphire to it, you got Jirachi, the legendary Pokemon. And there was even, like, a Pokemon bank. I never had this, but you could get this where you could buy a disc where you could store, like, an extra 500 Pokemon back when we didn't have, like, Pokemon cloud storage, which is what the 3DS has now. You know, it's just built in, so you would have to do it on the GameCube and things like that. So there were a lot of interesting experiences like that. I think with Metroid Prime and Metroid Fusion came out on the same day. And if you hooked up Metroid Fusion to Metroid Prime, you got stuff, including I think you could unlock the original Metroid in Metroid Prime that way.
So,
and you could have Samus have the Fusion suit. It's kind of funny to me that there are still handheld devices, but like the 3DS and the Wii U, the only similar interaction is you can use a 3DS as a controller in 8-player Smash for Smash Bros. On Wii U if you don't have 8 Wiimotes or something. But other than that, there's not a lot of connectivity there.
Which is especially crazy given that like the nature of them both being internet-enabled devices means that like it should be way easier for them to have all that interaction as opposed to having to fucking buy a cable.
Exactly. And the Vita has remote play, but they haven't done anything else beyond that.
Yeah.
So I think the GameCube had a lot of sort of potentially revolutionary things that didn't necessarily go anywhere.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it kind of felt like, because like the GameCube sold well enough, but like it did not burn up the charts, but the Game Boy Advance definitely did, and especially like the SP, so part of that kind of feels like, you know, the Nintendo handheld line has been historically extremely successful, whereas like the Nintendo 64 and GameCube and like that was a bit more chaotic and up and down. So trying to have that synergy there, the smart.
Right.
It's like I never really took advantage of it, even though I had both the systems.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about this all day, and I've played so many GameCube games. Most of them I don't necessarily even have because this was back when you would rent games.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I rented, like, I don't think I ever owned it, but I played a lot of Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 4 on the GameCube.
Okay, I didn't even know that was a GameCube game.
Yeah, so I think it was also on the PS2.
Yeah, it was definitely a PS2 game.
Yeah, so things like that. That's where I originally played all the DBZ Budokai games.
Yep, I have Budokai 2 still for my GameCube.
Right, you know what? I don't think Budokai 3 came out. One and two. Okay, 3 was only PS2. Yeah,
now I remember that. Because I wanted Budokai 3, and it did. I think Budokai 3 was only on the PS2 because it wasn't on the Xbox or the GameCube, so I couldn't have it.
Dragon Ball Z went PS2 exclusive for a while because all the Sparking games, Tenkaichi Budokai games, or how were they called that? Yeah, were also here. So, or were only on the PS2, so things like that. No, especially they came out.
Out on the Wii eventually.
Yeah. It's all weird.
Because that's how I played Budokai Tenkaichi 2, which is a good one.
I have that one. Yeah, it's a good one. But anyway, so yeah, that was kind of strange. But yeah, so I've played a lot of GameCube games. So I was bringing this back to that. You know, I've experienced the cross synergy with the Game Boy in a couple ways because I was so into my Game Boy. Mm-hmm. This was back when I actively read Nintendo Power, and I got that every month. So you know, I was full on the Nintendo train back then. And the GameCube, you know, it was a really cool console to have. It was not perfect. It had its flaws. It's the only Nintendo console that does not have a great Mario game, for instance. Which is weird.
Have you ever played Super Mario Sunshine?
Never to completion. I've played a good chunk of it.
Yeah. I don't know anyone who's played it to completion.
Let's talk about Mario Sunshine.
Let's talk about Super Mario Sunshine.
I want to start with the positive, which is that we've talked about this before, that Zelda Ocarina of Time cast such a shadow over Zelda that they've never really been able to escape it.
Yeah, that was like the death of Twilight Princess, is that it just feels so beholden to what Ocarina of Time was that like it's terrified almost of Ocarina of Time's legacy.
And weirdly, Mario has never had that problem with Mario 64, and I do think you have Mario Sunshine to thank for that. Because while Mario Sunshine was not a fully successful experiment, they took some of the bones of 64, but they said, we're going to put this in a totally different package. We're going to try something totally different. It technically has the overworld level structure, but if you've never played Sunshine, like, I honestly would recommend looking at videos or something because it's such a fascinating game.
Yeah.
Because you land on this island, Isle Delfino. The game has beautiful art direction and I think a lot of cool design work and stuff.
Yeah.
But Mario is basically framed because there's an evil version of Mario who is graffitiing the island, and you as Mario have to, like, you get this this system. What's it called?
The Flood.
The Flood, yeah.
F-L-U-D-D.
And Flood, like, talks to you. It has actual dialogue. And you use that as, like, you can do this double jump with it, and you can spray water. And now Mario has that in all the Smash Bros. Games. And you basically have to clean up the graffiti with that, and then you also use it in the levels. And basically, you clean up enough graffiti, you get the equivalent of, like, a painting in 64, and then you can jump through that, and you can do a level where you have to get shine sprites. So certain things of the setup are like Mario 64, but no one would ever play the two games and say they feel all that similar.
No.
You know, so I love the creativity of Mario Sunshine. I kind of love the overall voice of that game.
Although, the actual literal voice of that game is terrible. Have you ever seen the cutscene that plays at the end of it? Did you ever, like, watch it on YouTube?
Yeah.
The voice actor for Bowser.
Not good.
Nope.
No.
Bowser should not talk.
Honestly, I think, now that I think about it more, while Mario Sunshine is not a great Mario game, I think so much of the existing Mario legacy we have to thank for it, because it figured out what not to do with Mario and how experimentation is important. Mm-hmm. Because, like, we've gone back to, we don't do voice acting in Mario. And I think that's a good choice. Mario is like Charlie Chaplin. I never need to hear him or his characters talk.
Yeah.
But not Charlie Chaplin the actor, but like the Tramp character.
Yeah.
And I think that's the right choice. And we've learned that with Mario Sunshine. But you had to try it somewhere, right?
No, you didn't. Like, it felt like it was such, like, a non-Nintendo move. Like, it's something where you look back at it and you're like, was this game, like, developed by someone else? Is this, like, those, like, handheld Legend of Zelda games that were developed by Capcom, even though, like Minish Cap and stuff, those are still good. But, like, there's something about it, it's like, it distinctly does not feel like a Nintendo game.
Yeah, and so while the voice acting is bad, that's just one small part of it. To me, the big thing with Mario Sunshine is it controls like ass.
Yeah, and the camera's bad.
Yeah, the camera's bad. His general movement doesn't work well. The Flood thing is kind of, it's cool, but it's tough to use.
I feel like the world design just, like it, the art design looks good, but the world felt bland.
Yeah.
It's just not, like, the levels aren't fun. They're not interesting.
It looks like a platformer, but it doesn't play like one, almost. Yeah. And I think it's tough, because, again, I don't think it's a bad game or anything, but it really doesn't feel like a good Mario game. And part of that is you can go back to Mario 64 or any other 2D or 3D Mario game, and they control beautifully. It's a trademark of that series, and it's why it survived. And Sunshine, to me, sticks out as the one that doesn't. So that's why that one kind of falls flat. But I do appreciate the experimentation. I think they swung for the fences on that one. And if the swing missed, the swing was very important, I think, to Mario's history.
Yeah. Now, I have brought up here, just for fun, what the Flood, what the Flood acronym stands for. Just because I always like it when, you know, obviously they came up with the name Flood and then they decided an acronym. It stands for the Flash Liquidizer Ultra Dowsing Device.
That is the most Japanese thing I've ever heard.
Yep, so there you go. That's, you know, if you really want need to get a Flash Liquidizer Ultra Dowsing Device,
okay.
Delfino Isle is where to go.
Assuming Final Fantasy sticks around long enough.
Yes.
How long before a Final Fantasy game includes, like, a club or a group of characters who have called themselves that exactly?
I would give it Final Fantasy 22.
Okay.
Is when you will have
that
the group of characters that hail from the Flash Liquidizer Ultra Dowsing Device Club.
That really does sound like a Final Fantasy name.
Yeah, it does. It sounds like some, like, crazy invention that Sid came up with or something.
Yes. All right.
It was invented by Professor E. Gadd, Elvin Gadd, the one named Toad, who is not just called Toad, because everyone, all the humans in the Mushroom Kingdom are racists, because they just, like, refer to them by their species name.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to give some other perspectives. I'm going to give my top five GameCube games in a minute.
Okay.
But let's talk about a few others. So, I'll start with you. Do you have a favorite GameCube game besides Melee?
It would have to probably be Sonic Adventure 2, because, like, okay. The thing is, like, I would probably should be, like, Wind Waker or Metroid Prime, but I never finished either of those games because I just couldn't, like, I like and respect Metroid Prime, and I wish I still had it, but I gave my, like, Metroid Prime game to a friend because,
I'll lend it to you if you want it.
Sure, because, like, I just, like, I feel like I need to go back to that game, but I remember as a kid just hitting this point where I was like, I'm kind of done with this. The same thing with Wind Waker is, like, you get, like, a little bit past when you get the Master Sword and stuff. It's like, I'm, like, I don't want to sail around all, like, and that was kind of, like, the experience for me playing GameCube was, like, Super Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time were great. They were amazing. They're two of, like, these all my all-time favorite games. And get the GameCube. And then, like, Wind Waker's like, this is pretty good, but man, the back half of this game gets slow, and then it's like Super Mario Sunshine's like, fucking, I don't think I even got like a fourth of the way through that game before I was like, I am fucking going to return this to GameStop, because no thank you.
Yeah.
So they would probably have to be like Sonic Adventure 2 and Super Smash Bros. Melee are the big ones for me, I think.
Yeah. You know, I just had another thought. You're naming all these games, and it's going to come up as a theme in my list too. I think graphically, the GameCube was just one of the most beautiful consoles. When I think of the kinds of art styles, and I know you look back at it now on an HDTV or something, there's the Jaggies and all that, but you know, Wind Waker and Smash and Melee and Mario Sunshine and some of the Kirby games on there and all these other ones I'm talking about. Like, I just felt like Nintendo experimented with art style and stuff. Metroid Prime is another great one where it's almost like no two GameCube games looked alike, but there was just general experimental aesthetic that I loved to GameCube games. And like Sonic felt right at home there. Some of the others, Sega actually had a field day. They had things like Beautiful Joe and Billy Hatcher and the Dragon Hatcher and things like that. All these games that just, the GameCube I remember visually so powerfully.
I mean, it was something where I feel like a lot of the developers, like specifically Nintendo, obviously, but then other developers like Sega and stuff, put out a lot of the games they put out more specifically for the GameCube, because of like Nintendo's sort of style, were going for that more like sort of cartoonish visual aesthetic, whereas the original Xbox and PlayStation 2, like, I mean, PlayStation 2 definitely had its cartoony platformers, but you know, you had like, games like Halo or Knights of the Old Republic and stuff of that generation that were trying to go for the more realistic graphics or like Medal of Honor, stuff like that. That's like...
The GTA games.
Yeah, I mean, in their day, they looked good, but when you look back on them now, they have aged terribly, where it's like, you know, like the HD version of Wind Waker is completely gorgeous, but the original version of Wind Waker still looks really good, and that soundtrack is still... Like, that is the one thing I will say for Wind Waker, is that it is maybe the best soundtrack for a Legend of Zelda game. It is definitely, like, it is that or Ocarina of Time for me.
Absolutely, I agree. And I to the point where I don't think they remastered the Wind Waker soundtrack when they did the HD version.
Yeah, you don't need to.
So it's fine, it's great.
That good.
Yeah. All right, so I did text my brother Thomas today and just ask him for some GameCube memories, because he played the GameCube even more than I did, and it was just our console together for so long. And I said, what's your favorite GameCube game? And expected answer, I had to push him after this. But he said, Twilight Princess, although I never played the GameCube version. That's because that's...
What? That doesn't count.
Yeah, I know. I said, well, you've...
Because one, fuck you, Twilight Princess is terrible. How is that a better game than Wind Waker if you're going to pick a Zelda game? And two, if you didn't even fucking play the GameCube version, you have no idea. Maybe it being all flipped around the vertical axis makes the game terrible from your perspective.
Well, I did point out the HD version on Wii U is more based on the GameCube version, so he's kind of played it.
Except for, but that's the HD remastered version, so that doesn't...
Anyway, so I said... What else? And he said, you know, he loves Wind Waker. He poured it. It's one of the first games. It was the first Zelda he played when it came out, because he was too young.
Yeah, that's kind of the same for me, because I played Ocarina of Time a couple of years after.
But that's also the console where he first played Ocarina of Time, because they released that special disc.
The Master Quest, yeah.
Yeah, that was cool. And Majora's Mask. So he played all of those there. So this was the console where he discovered Zelda. And he also pointed out a game we haven't mentioned yet, which is Luigi's Mansion. Which
is sort of classic. It was a game that was really cool, but like was not the game anyone was expecting to be the launch game for the GameCube.
I feel like history, though, has wound up being very kind to Luigi's Mansion. Like,
sure,
that is a game that I think has a pretty ample following at this point. In that
it's just so different. Like, there are almost no games like it, other than like the pseudo sequel they made on like the 3DS or whatever.
Yeah, and even that just didn't do it for people, because it didn't have that same kind of just unique, weird energy.
Yeah, I feel like Luigi's Mansion really kind of set the tone for the GameCube going forward.
Absolutely,
and Nintendo's output on it.
It's probably one of those classics with an asterisk.
Yeah,
but it's still a classic.
Yeah,
so there's that. He talked about playing, you know, Melee as recently as this summer, and that's so fun. The Sonic games. And he says there were quite a few Sonics. Adventure, Heroes, Shadow, all those old collections.
Shadow's not a Sonic the Hedgehog game. It's a Shadow the Hedgehog game. It doesn't count.
And then, now I have to tell a story that's going to embarrass me.
You or Thomas?
Me.
Oh, okay. Like, I didn't know if you're still talking Thomas's voice.
I mean, Thomas will tell the story, but it embarrasses me.
Okay.
So, also talked about the game Animal Crossing, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. This is where... Technically, that was a port of an N64 game from Japan, but everyone in the West, we found it on GameCube.
Yes.
And he said, and I legitimately did not have memory of this until he started talking about it. Thomas did. Thomas said to me, remember how you wouldn't let me play Animal Crossing for a while? What? And I said, what? I wouldn't? Why? And Thomas said, yeah, you thought there could only be one file, so you didn't let me play until I convinced you there was more than one file. And now I remember that, and this was a thing. I thought in Animal Crossing, because it came with the special... I'm a dumb kid. It came with the special memory...
I'm a dumb adult, too, but...
Yeah. It came with a special memory card and stuff, and I didn't know you could have other people play on the same save file. And I thought if he played it, it would, like, delete my town. And so I did not let Thomas play that for a few months, apparently. And then finally he did, and he played it way more than me. But, yeah. So apparently I was a huge dick. I'm a horrible person.
That's, like, hilarious, and... That totally sounds like something you would fucking do. Like, you would completely misunderstand how that would work on a fundamental level in a way that's utterly baffling for the average person who plays video games, and then you'd be a complete fucking asshole to your younger brother and, like, not let them play on Animal Crossing. Like, yeah, at least let him fuck around in your town if you think it's gonna delete your town.
I don't know. I think that was also, like, that was the game I got for Christmas, and he was more of the gamer when we were kids, and so it's like, this is the one game that's mine. You have Sonic and all this stuff. I don't know, I'm a dumb kid.
Like I said, you're a dumb adult.
Okay. All right. My top five.
Oh, but before we move on, I like him going down some of those games for what it made me remember. I don't own it. I only ever rented it, but I have such fond memories of it as the Nintendo GameCube game is Pikmin. Pikmin was fucking awesome. Like,
yeah.
It's always a game I kind of wish I had owned, and I kind of want to go back to it, but at the same time, I feel like my memories might be kind of tarnished. But, like... That's another one of those, like, GameCube-ass games to me, kind of like Luigi's Mansion. That's why I think I remembered it. Is that it's like, it still sort of feels like a Nintendo game, but it's not like the Nintendo games you've played. Like, it's sort of, you know, it has that, like, Miyamoto touch, Pikmin specifically, that you've got, like, that Nintendo feel to it. But it's not, you're not playing as Mario, you're not playing as Link, but you're in this weird sort of space world where you're playing as Olimar and you have all your Pikmin guys and it's, you know, this weird, almost kind of photorealistic for the time looking ground and stuff like that with all these big cartoon animals in it that you, like, you know, throw fucking little tiny people at giant monsters to get them to try to kill it. Like Pikmin's just, it was a really cool, weird experimental game.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right, my top five, starting, actually, it's really a top six because I have an honorable mention.
Okay.
And that is Kirby Air Ride.
Okay, I never played that one.
Kirby Air Ride is a really cool game that also has to have the asterisk by it because it's sort of... It's not unfinished, but it was trying something so different that it doesn't feel like maybe whatever the full version of itself is. It's basically a pseudo-racing game where you're Kirby and friends and you're on different warp stars and you have tracks and objectives. But the core of the game for a lot of people was actually this really cool mode that I wish they would make a sequel and expand on this, where you just had city free roam and competition, where they had this big, like, for the time, like what looked like kind of a big open world map where you're Kirby and friends, or actually you're not even friends, you're just different colored Kirbys, and you're on this map and you could explore the city. There were lots of secrets to find. It was just fun to dick around in there, and you could get your different stars and you could try out all the different warp stars in there, and you just kind of played around. And this is a HAL Laboratories game, because Kirby is HAL Laboratories and HAL Laboratories makes Smash Bros.
Right.
So actually a lot of Smash Bros. Comes from Kirby. Like, yeah. Kirby is the most dominant franchise in Smash Bros., even if you don't know that. It really, a lot of the visuals are from Kirby. And so this was the team that made Melee. This was their next game. And it's very unique. I think it's kind of a lost classic. It's something I wish they would go back to, because it was such a cool idea. And I think in HD and stuff now, you could make something really neat and interesting and different out of it. But at the time, I mean, my brother and I played this a lot. We still go back and play it sometimes. It just, there was something about it that kind of awoke the imagination in a really fun way, where you would just had this little world to explore and play around in, and you just came up with stories, and we played around in it. It was just this little sandbox. And I love that. I can't think of a game since that's kind of done that same thing for me. So,
right.
But I did a lot on the GameCube. So Kirby Air Ride, not as good as the next five games on this list, not as influential, but I think a lost gem of the GameCube.
Okay.
Number five.
Yes.
Mario Kart Double Dash.
That I know lots of people don't like Mario Kart Double Dash. I really like Mario Kart Double Dash.
Mario Kart Double Dash is the shit.
Yeah.
The dual racer mechanic was really cool. To have two people on your kart at once, one who throws items, one who drives. Whether you're doing that in co-op and being a dick and making someone throw items, as I often did to Thomas. Sorry, Thomas.
Yeah, we've already have like heard enough about your toxic relationship with your younger brother.
Yes. Anyway, but really just having the two, and you could kind of flip and throw the items as one, or they could each hold items so you could get more items. It made it kind of fun, chaotic in a really fun way.
Yeah.
But on top of that, that game just had a cool sense of speed, and it had the best maps. Like, the courses in Mario Kart Double Dash are fantastic. Yeah. They still are. Whenever they make a new Mario Kart game and one of the retro courses is from Double Dash, I just, like, I'm excited because I want to play a Double Dash course.
Double Dash is also a great name for that game. Like, it's a pun, and it's an alliteration, and it sounds good. It's everything you need in the subtitle.
Absolutely. It was a blast. It's got phenomenal music. It was so chipper and cheery, and it had some of that weird GameCube aesthetic, like I said, we all love.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Double Dash, we did not have a better Mario Kart console game until 8, and even then, 8 is just a really good, refined version. It's not as kind of innovative and crazy as Double Dash
was. Like, Double Dash I have such fond memories of, because I had one specific friend who owned a Double Dash, and there was, like, just one summer where, like, I would go over to his house, like, practically every day, because I could just walk there, and we'd play Double Dash all the time, because it was such a fun co-op game, yep. And, like, a competitive game, because you could just play it either way. It's like, that was, like, kind of, I feel like, I probably actually technically played more Mario Kart 64, because we owned that, and my brother played it all the time, and I would play with my brother and stuff. Like, my most fond memories are definitely of playing Double Dash in that kind of co-op way.
Yes, absolutely. Number 4 for me is Animal Crossing, the original Animal Crossing. Animal Crossing has had many sequels since. I don't think any have surpassed this original, just in terms of how much they gripped me and how much there was to sort of explore and discover. The magic and the beauty of Animal Crossing is in having... It's sort of, you know, we value in games today size and scope and giant open worlds and hundreds of hours of new stuff to do, and to the point where we have a game now that literally promises you the infinity of the universe, and people are disappointed in it.
Yeah.
But the beauty of Animal Crossing is that it is not that, and it achieves more than a lot of those games can. Because it's small, it's just your little town, your little corner of the world, your small number of activities to do. But it's a town that feels alive. It was one of the first games ever advertised as really moving and living and breathing while you weren't there. It had an internal clock. It needed its own memory card. If you left it for a week, people in the town would be mad at you, and there would be weeds and things like that.
They would all be dead because they just can't function without you, their Lord and Savior among them.
But Animal Crossing was definitely a GameCube game I really threw myself into and played an absolute ton of, and I loved every minute of it. It was such a fun game to play and to build your town and to have that sense of ownership. And I think it's been very influential on games since. I feel like while Stardew Valley takes a lot, obviously, in terms of mechanics from Harvest Moon, something about it feels like it's probably equally, if not more, influenced by something like Animal Crossing. Because, again, Animal Crossing has endured as this kind of calm, quaint, small game that you can play a ton of and that people are still addicted to, and I think it's opened the door again for games like that as that franchise has continued. But I do think the GameCube version was the best. I think it had the most kind of imagination, the best characters. Just the sense of discovery as you found what the rhythm was. The new Animal Crossing games don't have that because they kind of just do the same thing. But the original Animal Crossing, realizing what would happen when you paid enough to Tom Nook and he upgraded his store, or you upgraded your house, or you could find the different NES games and you could just fucking play The Legend of Zelda in Animal Crossing on the GameCube.
Right. Before they were just selling that on the side for $5 so they wouldn't put it in their games anymore.
Right. Stuff like that. Just a magical game. I love it. Every once in a while, I'll go back to my old town, see all the weeds, and turn it off immediately. But
Your fucking neighbor's just, like, hung himself in it. Yes. Like, their meaning for existence has just abandoned them for years.
Yep. All right. Number 3. Okay. Sonic Adventure 2 Battle.
Yes.
God, I've played a lot of this game. And God, Thomas has played, like, 5 times as much.
It's a good game.
It's a great game. We've talked about it a lot this year with the Sonic retrospective we did. And, man, you know, the Chao Garden, some of the multiplayer stuff. The way you could get the different emblems at the end, or just replaying and experiencing some of those great levels again. Even once you had played the campaign of Sonic Adventure 2 once, there was so much more to do, and it was just sort of this evergreen game for that generation that we kept coming back to, and that I still play sometimes today. And I wish... It's like the one Sonic game on the Xbox 360 they haven't upgraded to backwards compatibility.
Yeah.
They have Sonic the Fighters on Xbox One.
So, yeah, right. They fucking did release that game on Xbox Live Arcade, didn't they?
Yep, and it's on Xbox One backwards compatibility, but the Sonic Adventure 2 version isn't. Fuck you guys.
Sonic the Fighters, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Anyway, Sonic Adventure 2 Battle, we've talked about it. Anything more to say?
It's a good game. That Chao Garden, man. Oh, fucking That Chao Garden.
Number 2, Super Smash Bros. Melee.
How? That's number 2? Oh, okay, I know what number 1 is.
Yeah. I could go either way with number 2 and number 1. I don't know. It's kind of a tie that I broke for totally just random reasons.
Right.
But Melee, fantastic game. A template for so much that was to come in terms of, you know, it just was not surpassed for so long. And if it's diminished at all in my memory, it's only because we finally have a better Smash Bros. Game.
Right.
But of course, that better Smash Bros. Game couldn't exist without Melee, which just did... It took the bones of this, you know, great concept that was Smash Bros. On the N64 and blew it up into something so weird and special and vast.
Yeah, like, just, like, think about, like, all the content that Super Smash Bros. Melee has, you know? It's just one of those games that kind of, like, Halo 3 felt the same way when it came out of, like, holy shit, this game has a lot in it. It's like, you have your classic mode, you have your adventure mode, you have, like, versus, you have all these different challenge modes, you have, like, all, like, the target practice stuff got, like, bounced out and, like, fucking, like, fleshed out and, like... There's so many different things, different types of mode, different items, options, everything. Like, it was just a game that, like, had everything, and you could play it so endlessly. The tournament mode that I would play with my friends all the time. Like, all that stuff was... Smash Brothers Melee is an incredible game.
Incredible game, and definitely...
The trophies that you could get.
Yeah. It's tough to know how to make this list, because if I'm going by nostalgia and my memory and my experience as a kid, it's unambiguously number one.
Yeah.
But I guess I was trying to say, what are the five kind of... best in terms of endurance and all that. So my number one there is Metroid Prime.
Yeah.
And Metroid Prime is a game I definitely did play on the GameCube back in the day, although I don't think I ever owned it. I think I rented it and would play it. And I never beat it back then, although I really liked it and was kind of mystified by it. But I did finally go... Where I've beaten it is on the Wii version, which is a slightly... It's the same game. It's just got the different controls.
Yeah.
But I feel like for the purposes of this list, it is a GameCube game. It qualifies here, and I do think it's the best game on the GameCube. In fact... I think Metroid Prime, to me, belongs in that same rarefied space of Nintendo 3D games as Legend of Ocarina of Time and Super Mario 64. It just came a little late to the party.
Okay.
But it is the classic 2D series comes to 3D and just revolutionizes everything it's trying to do. And to the point where Metroid, like, Ocarina of Time and Mario 64 did things that were sort of repeatable and became just part of video game language.
Yeah.
And I do think Metroid Prime did in some ways, but not in as big of ways. But overall, Metroid Prime did something so weird and against the grain that I think it's never entered that same space for people because it hasn't left that same influence, even though I do think it's every inch as good a game as those other two I mentioned. You know, because this was during the first-person shooter console revolution. Halo's out. Yeah. You know, Call of Duty's about to become a big thing, and it's going to be for shooting and combat. And Metroid Prime said, no, we're going to use first-person space, and we're going to use it for an exploration adventure game. And I do think in some ways its legacy is being caught up to. We do have games that are first-person adventure exploration games now, and I think they're becoming a bigger and bigger thing on the indie game scene.
Yeah.
And I think you could say Metroid Prime has left a legacy with indie game developers these days. And you do hear people behind those games mention Metroid Prime as an influence.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, like, it's interesting because, like, at the same time as Metroid Prime did that on the consoles, I feel like there were a lot of PC shooters that were doing the same thing in a slightly different way on the PC. And, like, you kind of have seen that, like, influence kind of, like, come back around to games, like, almost like I mean, BioShock is, like, that direct legacy, like, System Shock 2 and stuff. I think you also see, like, Gone Home.
Yes.
Games like that have that legacy in kind of, like, both camps.
Mm-hmm. Because you do shoot a gun in Metroid Prime, but the combat is so the least important part of that game. And the combat's great, but it's the exploration and the scanning and the lore and just the overwhelming sense of atmosphere and that phenomenal music and just the beautiful graphics and game design that absolutely holds up. Even, you know, I'm playing the Wii version stretched on my widescreen TV. Beautiful looking game. And, you know, I could also put Metroid Prime 2 somewhere on this list because I think it's fantastic. But Metroid Prime is sort of this rare example of... It was the first game in a series, and I know Metroid is a longer series, but you know what I mean.
It's of the Prime games. The other Metroid games are so different.
Right. It was the first game, and they nailed it so completely and perfectly the first time out, it almost meant there was nowhere to go but down, and that Metroid Prime 2, phenomenal game, slightly lesser. Metroid Prime 3, I don't really care for in what I've played of it. And, you know, now you have some of these same developers who were kind of in the wild for a while, now coming back with something like ReCore. And I do think it's one of those things where it's almost like Orson Welles with Citizen Kane.
Right.
You hit it so hard the first time, it's like the rest of your career will have great high points, but be a very different thing.
Yeah.
And I do think Metroid Prime is being, I think, it's always been acclaimed. I think it's being more and more rediscovered for whatever reason. It's coming. I feel like people have been discussing it more in the last few years, as I think it's starting to enter that same classic space as some of those other all-timer Nintendo games.
No, I mean, it's entering, like, it's getting into that nostalgic place where, like, people like us who played it when we were younger, yeah. like, you know, that is like a game of a lot of people's childhoods that are now adults, you know, so it is
right.
Becoming that thing again.
Absolutely. So, if you've never played Metroid Prime, it's fantastic. GameCube version, Wii version, whatever. I mean, if you have a Wii U, you can get it right now for $20. You can get the whole trilogy on Wii U and play it through the Wii. You have to have a Wiimote, but
yeah.
You can play it, and that's a great deal. So, yeah, Metroid fucking Prime. Great, great, great game.
Super Smash Bros. Melee is also really good.
Really good. Those are five great games.
Yes. I mean, yeah, no, yeah.
You can make a fucking solid top five with this. I mean, we talked about with the N64 that the N64 had these incredible pockets of depth, but very little breadth to it.
Yeah.
The GameCube was almost the opposite. The GameCube does have a breadth of really good games. Its pockets of depth are probably narrower.
Yeah.
But it's a good console.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like, I think it, like, it's one of those things kind of like with the N64 where I feel like the console that had some really good games, but, like, part of me just feels like, was it actually a good console? Like, when you had the shitty little tiny discs and stuff, and it was, like, the underpowered one, like, it sold very little, it didn't sell, like, nothing, but it did sold very poorly for, like, what it needed to do next to the PlayStation 2. They price dropped it so immediately, so hard, so severely, that's, like, I have such fond memories of the GameCube. It had such great, a handful of such great games, but when you look back on it, like, was it actually a good console? And it's such a hard thing to sort of parse that out, you know?
Yeah.
But Super Smash Bros. Melee is great. There's no denying that.
Indeed. All right. Next week, we'll talk about next stuff. Week.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out. Fuck.
I need to write a lot about some Godzilla movies, and I probably should rewatch some of them, but, like, some of those Godzilla movies are not very good. Surprise, surprise. Even for me.
I am excited to see your list. I'm excited to talk with you about it on the podcast. I'm going to try to watch some of these movies, but that'll be next month. For the rest of September, we're just going to keep on trucking and see what we can play and talk about.
Be Destiny comes out basically a week from now, the new expansion.
So. Yep. So lots of stuff.
More Hitman. Always coming. Always killing.